Now you have the opportunity to buy a unique poster containing a screenshot of every single millennial stream ever. The entire smorgasbord, the full gamut, the whole shebang, all in one incredible display commemorating the first decade of this festival. Available in portrait or landscape. Buy yours now.
All right. Hello. Welcome back to Millennial X. And I'm now here with the second banquet for this year, second banquet ever. And it is USA centric. And there are five guests here just now. More may show up later on. That is the general idea with these, that people will come and go throughout the duration, which will be about 3 hours. So welcome. All of the guests have appeared on Millennial in the past. Charles Spadil with Whiskey and Ashes was on this year. Ryan was on, I think, 2 years ago, as was 17th Century Shite Poster. And I think Radlib was on 3 years ago. And Charlemagne has been on several times, I think most recently last year as part of the Old Glory Club. So welcome to all of you. So I guess, just to get it started with a very pertinent issue, and why not, because this is something that has exploded since the last Millennial interview 4 days ago. And I think it is indicative. It's actually a very pertinent topic because it speaks of America, the state of America today, in a very broad way. And I think each of you will probably have something to say about this. I should say, beyond this topic, that this will be the opening topic. But beyond this, I don't mind if it goes more informal and people start changing the topic and so on. That's absolutely fine, as long as it remains relevant to our sphere. Oh, here's Praise of Folly. Welcome. And all right, so Radlib, why don't you get us started on the H-1B debacle?
Yeah, well, it's quite funny, the timing of it, because, you know, I'm doing Christmas with my large family and everything, and, you know, every so often taking a quick peek at Twitter, and it's absolutely exploded. did it start on Christmas Eve, I think? But certainly Christmas Day just, you know, is like a running gun battle on Twitter between Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, hopefully I'm saying that right, on one side, and a number of others promoting H-1B and how for America to win, we need to bring in bright people from all over the world. So it's basically a pitch for immigration, which seems a little tone deaf after Trump won on not just slowing down immigration, but on re-migration, which, you know, kind of a shock. This has been something that you'd get kicked off platforms for bringing up, and Trump was talking about it openly during his campaign. So anyway, that sort of strange for them to bring this up. And then on the other side, you have, I hope I'm not, pigeonholing anyone, but the rest of us completely in opposition to turning America into Elon Musk's Mars factory, you know, and not a nation of people with its own history and culture and so forth. So hopefully I've set it up what's been happening the last few days absolutely ferocious back and forth. J.D. Vance recently weighed in with a retweet of someone quoting himself, saying that America is a nation and not just an economic zone. So, you know, just because Elon Musk says something does not mean that's representative of the Trump administration. So that's interesting. And for me, what was interesting is, you know, I'm always sort of interested in the intellectual debate. The issue ended up bringing up a lot of stuff we've been talking about for years, but a lot of stuff that I think some people had not realized that we'd already been talking about. And suddenly they were confronted with a lot of the arguments that millennial listeners are quite familiar with, right? You know, that a nation is more than an economic zone, maybe just, you know, importing half of India is not the way forward for America, and so on and so forth. So it really ended up blowing up into all kinds of amazing. I've had trouble keeping up with it all. Wonderful writing from a lot of our friends addressing various aspects of the debate. So it's really been wonderful, and it's just been happening while some of us are trying to like be with our families, you know.
Yeah, and doesn't that really sort of underline the exact schism here, which is that, you know, maybe a lot of these people who don't even celebrate Christmas are able to get into this ferocious fight while the rest of us are off, you know, enjoying what is my favorite holiday.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah, so I was on last year I was feeling okay about the state of things in general, but this year I am feeling like up until Christmas, and I think it's going to be fine, but I was feeling kind of nuclear white-pilled because the American right over the last few years has done the two critical things we needed to, which was kind of synthesize a new ideology that hadn't already been defeated by progressivism, and number two, generate a counter elite to wed to this ideology that could create the kind of political and elite arguments that could actually like get taken seriously by people like Elon Musk and Mark Andreessen and all these other people. And so these people joining us is a huge boon, obviously, and quite possibly the reason Trump wound up winning. Although there's a lot of things in his favor, not to mention Trump himself, but having them is clearly a huge advantage over where we were just a few years ago. And yet this kind of almost obvious schism is being revealed almost right away, right?
Silicon Valley versus the online right, something like that, right?
One thing I'd like to add first, just for clarification. So it's Elon Musk is leaning in favor of more H-1B visas, right?
He seems to be tacking back and forth a bit. Like he already seemed to back off and say, no, I don't mean mass immigration. I just mean the 0.1% of most brilliant people or something, you know, so that he's already been waffling.
He gave a specific number. He gave us the number 15,000 people is what is needed. The H-1B visa currently admits up to 65,000 people a year. So he's not necessarily saying it needs to be increased now, but he has said it's needed to be increased in the past, and he's retweeted himself or quote tweeted himself talking about how we need even more legal immigration. So he's clearly very much for the program and probably for expanding it, although he hasn't stated anything specific number wise which people have been asking. He won't really give very specific numbers.
Of note, he's also started to walk back some of his rhetoric. It was definitely much more gung-ho, open borders y for the last little bit until the massive backlash that's happened in the last couple of days. The dialogue has shifted in a very extreme anti-immigration direction, which I can only be optimistic about.
Well, let's not hold 2 days ago Elon against current day Elon, right? I mean, you know, don't get stuck in the past.
because I have a take I want to give on this, because I've been hearing a lot of this from different directions. I haven't been following it directly, but I think what we're seeing with Musk is that if we look at the culture war, if we step back a little bit and look at the culture war, the theory that I've been propounding for a while now is that the elites, whether they be the financial elites, the technological elites, or the political elites, which are all sort of nestled together in this post-war consensus, are all more or less more in common with each other than someone else, down the food chain of class. So the middle class, the lower class, the undocumented immigrants, which I guess are like untouchables, they don't really have any, they want to pretend to be your friend. You know, like Bill Clinton in the 90s campaign is, oh, I'm just a normal guy like you. No, you're not just a normal guy like any one of us. You're one of the blue bloods. Give me a break, right? And so I think Musk is like that too. And one of the things that he does is he sort of feeds red meat to the right to see how far he can pull or how far that elite can move or push or pull that group. Because as somebody just said, it was it's a new idea, a new identity that has not been already defeated by the left or the whatever, the progressives. So now they're trying to figure out, well, what can we do with this group? It's here now. Many of them are already quite wealthy as computer programmers and middle-class tradesmen. And so they have different interests. And this is where we get into the actual economics of the issue. From Musk's point of view, and from anybody like, you know, Microsoft, Apple, whatever, all the tech companies, they want to reduce the unit cost of the programmer as low as possible because that's skilled labor. The computer programmer could charge a lot for his work if there are not a lot of other computer programmers to compete with. And so you want to flood the market as much as possible, though that might be, and that might not be practical politically, but it might be the ideal economically. And the question is, there's a push-pull mechanism. How far can we go? How far can we push it? We'd like to push it as far down as possible, but that doesn't seem to be working anymore. So what can we do? And I think this is the capitalist class putting their toe in the water to see how far they can push this new political movement and to see how much of the immigration regime that they currently have they can still keep.
Well, the funny thing is, if Musk and Ramaswamy had left well enough alone, they probably just could have kept the regime as it was and even tailored it to suit their specific tech bro needs or whatever, if they had just left well enough alone. But for some reason, they decided to really push it. And I think it's been great to see that they were able to push it nowhere, and it snapped back pretty badly on them. And, you know, we have people in the Trump administration, like, Stephen mentioned, J.D. Vance sort of weighing in a very light way. It's pretty clear that this is not going over well in Trump's cabinet so far, and it's not going over well in any sector of the right on Twitter. So this was a huge misstep, and it's kind of strange that Musk decided to push on this right now. It's really remarkable.
Yeah, Stephen Miller should be mentioned, I think. Isn't he going to be in the administration? He's a real anti-immigration
deputy,
guy.
Deputy Chief of Staff.
Right.
It's worth noting, you know, the only guy who's really done anything recently on H-1B was Senator Jeff Sessions, and Miller was his top aide. So, I mean, this all started because of one staff appointment to, you know, senior counselor for AI or whatever it was, and it was this Indian, and that's what started this whole thing, and it was just a train reaction of one thing after another. But Stephen Miller is going to be in a much higher position than any of these people, and if you wanted to have one guy who knows the issue and has a proven record on this issue, it's Stephen Miller. So there are some reasons for optimism still.
Absolutely, yeah.
Since we're talking about people just tripping over themselves rhetorically and in dialogue and whatever else when they didn't have to, there's been quite a lot of people on the right as well outside of us that aren't tech bros themselves who have shown themselves to be completely worthless, if not counterproductive, when it comes to promoting the correct line or counter-signaling the correct line. The libertarians, for whatever reason, especially the Gen Xers and the libertarians, have decided to jump on Ramaswamy's jock versus nerd or whatever it was dichotomy, which I found interesting from Ramaswamy, but also the libertarians, just because it wasn't their fight, and somehow they've managed to lose it. But with Ramaswamy, it shows that none of these people have any idea what's actually happening in the schools, and I don't mean to constantly slam on this issue every time I get onto one of these streams, especially on Millennial, because I think this was my topic the last time I was on. The stratification that was depicted in the schools decades ago is not there right now. People are talking about how American culture elevates one group and not another group, but the groups just aren't there anymore. If any of these people knew what they were talking about, they'd be talking about the apathy that was going on in the schools right now to not actually achieve anything. But I can imagine why the tech bros aren't doing that in their rhetoric, because then that begs the question, why is there apathy? This hasn't been here in all of human history. And then you start uncovering that, well, white men and other high-achieving demographics have been biased against in admissions and job hirings and whatnot else. Mm-hmm. That you suddenly start uncovering that maybe the reason that there's a so-called skill shortage, if such a thing can even exist in an economy, I don't know how the needs of businesses can outweigh the needs of the consumers, but that's neither here nor there. Something that's very interesting to me is that this skill shortage seems to have been created. We didn't just happen upon it because the productivity grew faster than the consumers. That wouldn't make any sense at all. It seems to be that maybe these decades of biasing against whites, second generation Asians are also in this category. I'm sure probably a lot of Jews as well suffer from this apathy. I don't really want to make it about them in particular because they're quite small compared to the white men in middle America. But we never really hear about this apathy because all the people talking about this they get their information on the school system from Hollywood movies. It's infuriating to say the least.
I think your point regarding the apathy is absolutely correct. And my father was in education for 40 some years in Camden, New Jersey. I spoke about it when I was doing the series with Pete Canones, Race War in High School. If you happen to catch that, it might be very much in your bailiwick. But I'd like to step back. I do agree with your point, Ryan, about the apathy, but I'd like to step back a bit too regarding H-1B. I worked for USINS for many years, and I think what most Americans are woefully uninformed regarding H-1Bs is it's 90 to 95% fraud. It's legitimate fraud, but it's fraud nonetheless. You have all of these companies putting out these ridiculous job openings, and I use air quotes very strongly with this, job openings that either most Americans will never even see or they'll never even apply for. And that's set, it's written that way specifically. They have entire law firms dedicated to just this. Matter of fact, there's a fellow on Twitter talks about it frequently named Orkbrand. He talks about it frequently. He's well-informed with these law firms. That is their entire existence, is to write these job applications that no American will put in for, but they are tailor-made to bring people in from India and Africa and all these other countries. Because it's not just about, and I do agree with the other gentleman's point, about how it's an economic thing and these companies want the cheapest bottom line they can get. Yes, that is part of it, but it goes further than that. They also want a slave class, because what needs to be understood by the American people is the H-1B visa allows these people to come here and live here and have a job. Now, if your boss fires you, that invalidates your H-1B. You can't live here anymore. So you're far more willing to put up with terrible treatment, abysmal conditions, poor pay, lack of benefits, because you just want to stay here because it beats Calcutta or Bangladesh or whatever place you choose to mention. So I just wanted to bring those thoughts into the conversation for you, John.
And the thing is, once that becomes the standard, well then that becomes the standard. So if that's the sort of threshold, then okay, now everyone has to compete with, it's a bit better than Bangalore. So then that's America from then on. That's what a working class American can expect, is something a bit better than Bangalore. So then that degrades the entire society.
Correct, sir. It's a prisoner's dilemma. Yes,
exactly. Yeah. Semiogog.
Hello, gents. I would add to that, you know, the old thing about slaves working in the field and how they don't want to pick too much cotton one day because then the next day it's going to be expected of them. You know, once you set that, yes, that becomes the standard in terms of this sort of abject slavery, but there is perhaps no group of people. I'm just, you know, pulling this out of my aphorism jar, so your mileage may vary, but I expect there's no group of people on earth, from what I know of, the more adept at finding ways to avoid having to work. And we're not just talking about people from the Indian subcontinent in this instance. We're talking about IT people in general. Like, let's be real. I've worked in a number of corporations, and the single group of people most despised by everyone else are the IT guys who swan in and, you know, wave their fetishes around and call for rain and go through all sorts of ritual stuff to tell you, you know, how incomprehensible all of this process is. And then they roll back out again and sleep next to their monitor, you know. And I think it's worth backing up as well to look at the assumptions involved in this idea that we need to bring in the best and brightest in order for America to win. One of them is this idea, somehow incomprehensible to me, that transnational corporate structures in any way mirror or correspond to long abandoned national ones in terms of, you know, allegiance to the organization or security. There's the assumption that foreign nationals are going to feel any sense of obligation to the United States. The track record on that is rather sad. It's based on the assumption that employees don't move around, you know, that competing countries and companies can't poach talent from you no matter what visa system you have in place, no matter, you know, how encouraging it might be. It assumes that we've already identified and exhausted the currently existing pool of national talent, which is just preposterous. And there's also the assumption that real national security issues don't override petty details like immigration law. I mean, remember after World War II? I mean, some people have tweeted about this. You know, if you want to have the best rocket science talent, you know, it doesn't matter if they're former DAP rocket science scientists from the mid-century Germans. Yes. So there are all sorts of absurd presuppositions. And there's this whole business of a person like Vivek coming in, and I've just never liked him. A lot of people kind of got on board and said, yeah, you know, he might not be the best, but he can be really useful to me. I guess you probably in Britain don't have Slim Jim's woes, but there's this snack food that you can buy at the gas station that's like this meat stick. And as a kid, I always used to squeeze it to see what the hell was in it, and this weird grease would come out. That is Vivek Ramalama Ding Dong. Like he's just grotesque.
Well, it surely is not as bad as that other one who's emerged recently, who with the Herman Munster head.
Yeah,
oh, yes, that one. Looks like he's had some sort of weird, like, Mongolian, like, board strapped to either side of his head as a child to, like, deform his cranium. So there's this whole thing, all these people are popping up now to tell us about how we have to pull ourselves up by our non-existent bootstraps. And I just tweeted about it, but I think it sums it up. There's this is the way that the ones who work in the house always talk about the ones that work in the fields. That they're always going to justify their position in this fashion. And in summary, I guess to wrap up, because I tend to go on, I want to come back to something you tweeted, Woes, that I think really does sum this up, and it should be in the forefront of everyone's minds. There's always a reason, you know, it's that whole thing of because reasons. But no matter what the reason is, as you said in your tweet, what it always comes down to is there's a problem. We are that problem. We, the native populations, are that problem, and it's up to them. It's up to them to solve it. We are the problem that must be solved. And that's what I find most offensive about this.
You know, I want to add some clarity to this issue as well. And this is aping something I saw my friend Christopher Sandbatch tweet just a couple minutes ago. And that is that there's a racial aspect to this issue, because we focus a lot on Indians from the subcontinent because, you know, we have the quote, so like, tech bros.
They're so easy to, you know, yeah.
Sorry, exactly. But it's really not a racial issue. Okay. The issue is this: we are descended from the people who crossed the sea. Get out of my country. Okay. I have papers that prove my ancestors came here in the 17th century. This is my country, not yours. I do not care what your race is. I don't care if you're Indian. I don't care if you're European. I don't care if you're British. Get the fuck out of my country. We have had enough, right? And that is the single clarifying point of this issue. Like, Musk is trying to make it about race right now, and it really fundamentally isn't. It's that this is our country, not anyone else's. Get out. We are done with this.
But right, what he specifically said, what Musk specifically
said. Just let me say this, that I think the the issue is that white people, white Americans, are the problem in this case because they're too expensive. And I think there's a dream that you can get the same quality of work from non-whites who will demand much less pay. Radloib, do you want to go?
Yeah, just Charlemagne had shared with us the recent Elon Musk tweet from like 30 minutes ago. He says the point was not to replace DEI, which is one form of racism, sexism, with a different form of racism, sexism, but rather to be a meritocratic society. And I think the opponents in this debate, our friends, are doing a great job of pointing out that meritocratic means shipping people in without any concern for preservation of this nation, this historic nation, as Charlemagne has
brought
up.
It's like when left-wing governments want to import a better electorate. So in this way, it's corporatists wanting to import a better workforce, but a cheaper workforce, I think.
And in this case, it's bizarre and perplexing because it's essentially just, untrammeled globalism, which is one of like the two or three main core tenets of MAGA. So I don't know how these people aren't a little, how would I put it? I don't know how they wouldn't at least be willing to compromise with us on this, because like, this is what the platform has always been. Like, you don't get to just change it now, you know?
If I could comment briefly, there's an interesting perspective here in that there's only really one part of one side that understands what a nation is. And that's why I don't think the economic angle is the one to go for. It's the right tends to devolve into tired union propaganda that feels like it's a century outdated as soon as we start bringing up the economic aspect of this. Rather, I think something that's interesting is we really are the only ones that understand what a nation is. Even the so-called constitutionalists that claim to support the philosophies behind founding documents like the Declaration, the Constitution, or whatever else, they have no clue what a nation is. No one knows how to think like an early modern statesman except for the people on this side. So whenever you see tech bros, Elon Musk himself being an immigrant, Ramaswamy being a second-generation immigrant, and then all of their cohorts of internationalists and whoever else, Musk himself made this point. He views the country as a sports team that needs to win on the global stage. And you can point out contradictions with that. Obviously, our geopolitical enemies aren't importing India. That might give a hint as to whether that's a good move or not. But the very fact that they themselves, when they get to choose their own words, label America by analogy as a sports team, shows just how divorced they are from real things. Nations are real. They're a product of heritage, of lineage, producing multiple generations of people in one place. No one else understands this. And so even people on the right who want the same things that we do, but they have different reasons for it, that don't understand what a nation is, their arguments don't end up actually working, because you can argue economics and statistics, productivity, and whatever else all day. But you're never actually going to get to the moral point unless you know what a nation is, and that is, this is for us, not for them. America is a nation. It was a distinct nation. Our academics recognized this a century ago. The language is different from British English, or English, I guess. The lineage comes from specific parts of Europe and has intermixed to the point where it is distinct from those parts. We have our own land that we are tied to, and we have nowhere else to go. No one else would expect this of anywhere else, but it's because parts of the right have bought into this thing that America is an idea or whatnot else. Vance harps on this point. It's not original. It's this fundamental misunderstanding of what a nation is that has led to an argument even being had at all. It shouldn't be an argument. It's a fact. This is a nation. No one else is entitled to it except for the posterity.
And in some sense, that's an extended...
To add something here, I think that again, so you just read the tweet Radical Liberation from Musk. And I think what would help here is to go back to the insight of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes. When you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. So, of course, if somebody smart does something that's seemingly stupid, it's probably not what he's really doing. He's probably doing something else. Whatever that something else is, we might call that esoteric for the sake of our discussion. And I think the esoteric reality for someone like Musk or any other tech company, whether it's, Google or Microsoft or whatever, is the idea that when you look at costs, right, the entire goal is to cut costs. That was the race to the bottom in the 90s where everybody, you know, relocated the factories to China. And now they want, they're actually worried now because China is not going to let those factories go and they have pretty tight capital flight controls. And so the question then becomes, well, how do you keep driving costs down? Well, the one cost you can drive down completely is the person, which is why men like Musk are into automation, because whether it's automated trucks or robot factories in Japan or whatever, you can just completely dispense with the human entirely. And that's just straight profit, because yeah, you have to maintain the machine, but the machine can maintain itself if according to that thinking. And so you can just get rid of the human entirely. We're not there yet. And there's reasons to doubt we ever will, but I'm saying from their point of view, that's what they seem to be thinking. And so what they want to do is they want to depress the cost of labor as much as possible. And arguably, the boom of technology in the 90s was in part possible because of that. Because if you have a lot of high-skilled workers who get together and decide that they're not going to accept less than a minimum payment, there's not much you can do about it if there's no one else to call in. And that creates a sort of trap, a sort of incentive for corporations to become transnational. Because if you have a national market, and that national market is fully exploited, so to speak, then you reach full or near full employment. And if that's the case, you're one strike away from game over. And so they don't want that.
Specifically a strike. And I've heard people refer to these workers in, or seen people refer to these workers in some sense as scabs breaking through strikes. And the whole point that you bring up. Yeah, and the point you bring up about, corporate efficiency, business efficiency is one that's well taken that we should all really think about, because this whole thing of how the tech bros about businessmen, you know, how they're going to come in and save us, you know, it sort of fits in neatly with the very common slip that you'll hear people make where they'll refer to America as a company or a corporation. I mean, I hear that endlessly. People always make slip up and say the one thing rather than the other. And you have the idea of the president as a chief executive officer, these kinds of things. That's something that we should really consider, because the normal way that these people deal with coming in with a company and increasing efficiency that, you know, many of us have celebrated and thinking about what Doge might do, you know, in the best case scenario, it's to cut the fat. And it's to put people out to pasture, if not to send the knackered out old nags to the sausage factory. And so I can see an opportunity here if we were to jump to the subject of what can we do about this in terms of narratives and responses. Trump has set himself up on this platform of the American worker. And, you know, workers have seniority and there's a reason for it. You know, no one who's working for a company wants to be kicked overboard because they're a little bit older after they put in, you know, 20 or 30 years for the company. And so here we come back to some of the things that Ryan was just talking about. You know, this is a nation, and a nation is in some sense an extended family. And we have an obligation to the rest of our family, certainly our immediate families. The whole idea is that we're supposed to take care of them that came before. And this whole idea of corporate efficiency and the way in which bringing in these other people is in some sense, you know, strike breaking scabs, and the way in which, you know, we're supposed to kick people out who've, you know, helped to build this country, whose grandparents and great grandparents and great great grandparents helped to build this country. Perhaps we have an opening there to tie this to Trump's promise of helping out the American worker. Basically, these are the kinds of things that unions can take up as messages, and they're accustomed to doing so. You know, this idea of seniority and the rest. It's not just that you can do the job; it's that you've got a whole group of people, generationally speaking, who have seniority, and in some cases, actually, just do have it. Who are going to be pushed out because there's some, you know, new person who's better at the autistic thing of smearing their greasy little fingers over a flat black piece of glass that they call a telephone.
A few points to what you're saying. I really like that we do owe a debt. Remember, this country, we are Americans here. This country was founded for ourselves and for our posterity. So we have a responsibility to our ancestors who gave us this. This is why the libertarians drive me insane. Well, I don't owe anybody anything. You damn sure owe a lot of people quite a bit, actually. You owe them a lot. This nation, this country where we live, was wilderness. And they carved a country, a nation, and a people out of it. So I think we owe them quite a bit. And to step back to a point Colin raised earlier, well, you get what you pay for. If you want to get rid of all of your workers, if we are the problem, if Heritage Americans are the problem and you want to get rid of us, well, guess what, buddy? You're going to get what you pay for. If you want to bring in cheap labor, you get cheap labor. And that's what that's going to be. And well, I think it's – go ahead. I'm sorry.
This is something that interests me because the question that does Elon Musk actually think that this is going to lead to progress, that he'll get, he'll get to Mars faster with, Indian tech engineers or whatever?
Well, a few points to that, Colin, just to continue my thought process and to build off of what you're saying. I've been taking notes when all you gentlemen speak because you all have a lot of great things to say. So not only are you going to get what you pay for, as we've both said, Colin, it's also you have to understand that what is the purpose of building these things? I believe it was Ryan that said Elon keeps referring to us as a team. And I believe Semigaga was also talking about we're a corporation. It's like, well, I don't even think we're a team. At least on a team, when you were a kid, these guys were in your class or they were in your neighborhood and the goal was to work together and to win a game. What is the goal of the team now that is in America? What, to make some billionaire another $100 million? Is that my goal? Or is my goal to feed my family? You know, and is my goal a Christian goal or is it a Muslim goal or is it a Hindi goal? What is it? How are we coloring these things? I don't even think we're a team. I think even the idea of a team is a nonsense suggestion by Musk. I'm not saying Ryan called us a team. I'm saying Musk said that. And I think just the idea that we're even a team is silly because what are we even working toward? What's our goal? What's the unity that binds us as a group toward that goal? I don't even consider us a team. And lastly, to bring a few other points into clarity that you had raised, Semigog, was about the profiteering. Excuse me, Praise of Folly was talking about it, the profiteering and such. Well, Hershey, the man that created the Hershey Company in Pennsylvania, for those of you that aren't aware, he had an opportunity hundreds of years ago to get rid of about 30 or 40 guys with a new machine. I couldn't tell you exactly what it was. I'm not an expert on early 20th century manufacturing or late 19th century manufacturing, but he had an opportunity to get rid of about 20, 30 guys. And when the person was trying to sell him this machine said, hey, it'll save you a lot on labor costs. Hershey said, I don't want it. And the guy said, well, why wouldn't you want it? It's going to save you labor costs. And he says, well, what it's going to do is it's going to defer my costs down the road. Because if I get rid of these 30 or 40 men, who's going to pay the taxes that keep my vehicles on the road, delivering my chocolate? Who's going to pay the taxes that keep the fire department from my building burning down? They would pay the police to guard my property, to guard my house. Who's going to have this society around me? Who's going to support this world that I live in if I just fire everybody and replace them with machines? So I just wanted to raise those points for you, gentlemen.
Just one thing. I want to say that it all reminds me, all of this H-1B thing, it all reminds me that 10 years ago, I did a video. It was in my first year, and I did a video called Immigration, Why Economic Arguments Are Pointless. And it was this basic point that I actually said in the tweet that Semiogog mentioned, which is that, there's always an economic argument for immigration. You can always say, because economics confuses people. It's a sort of like black magic or woo-woo. No one can understand it. So you can always say, well, it'll actually be great for the economy. It'll be in 10 different ways. And no one can argue against that. And now these tech bros are just doing the same thing again. And I think it doesn't. I think it's interesting because it's like people have moved past that. They're not going to be bamboozled by that anymore because they know it's not worth, or whatever the benefits, whatever the economic benefits, it's not worth the social costs and the demographic costs. Praise of Folly.
Yeah, so a couple points here. Firstly, to your point, Woz, The term you're looking for is the dismal science. That was used by Carlyle to describe the science of economics in his own day. But we've heard a lot of talk about a nation. What is a nation? America's a nation. The people we're arguing against don't understand what a nation is. But there's a very important question, which is deafening in the silence that it's not being addressed yet, is what does it look like for you to have an economics for a nation? Now, in the American context, prior to the free trade revolution after World War II, it was the Whig conception of internal development, which they got from the Germans. And so from like 1840 to the 1940s, that was how America was built up. And there was a Pat Buchanan once debated DiLorenzo on MSNBC about this. And, you know, it was a friendly debate, but he's like, look, the greatest American growth took place under all these tariffs. The other interesting thing is somebody brought up unions. I think that was Semiogog. For example, I thank Greg Johnson for this when I was going across his website when I first discovered it. You know, Jack London, you know, the famous American socialist, was also, for lack of a better word, a race realist, right? He was concerned about immigration from Asia. And so it looks like that if you look at what the American workers, because when we say American workers, we really mean, you know, heritage Americans. That's exactly what Jack London meant. And he was afraid that they would be wiped away by in his day, the immigration from China and Japan. Now, of course, it took a lot longer. And he was partly successful because in the 1920s, there was very serious immigration restrictions in place. And so I think what we're sort of getting at here is that with Jack London, with the early American socialists, right up to the mid-20th century Germans, I think we have an idea of what a national economy looks like. And it looks a lot different than what we have now.
And there's also the issue of what we're bringing in as a replacement. And aspects of this will be familiar to most, if not all of you. But India, I mean, I just did one of these damn AI overviews. According to the 2011 Indian census, there are over 19,500 dialects and 121 recognized languages spoken in India, with only 22 of them officially recognized by the government as scheduled languages. So you've got a so-called country that is a subcontinent. It only recently became a country. You know, you had Rajasthan, you had, you know, the Maharashtras, all these different groups that have been pressed together and in some sense are functioning as a country, at least when viewed from the outside. But for these people themselves, and I'm just taking the example of India, you could probably come up with similar information about China, despite the fact that we see it as a monolith from the outside. But these people themselves don't recognize countries as things to which you give allegiance. You know, with the Indians, there's always their uncle, you know, it's quote unquote uncle. It's like if you're talking to gypsies about scamming, they'll say, let me talk to my cousin, right? There's always someone to whom allegiance is owed within their network of relationships. And remember, these are people who have caste names as their last names. If you're a Reddy and that's your so-called surname, that's actually a caste name. I've had friends who told me stories of being in India where someone like spilled one of their soda drinks on the floor, and everyone in the office just walked through it. They just walked through it and tracked it around. No one was going to bend over to wipe it up with a wad of paper towels or whatever, because that would be taking someone else's job that they had fought for. This is a country where people sit in the gutter on the street where the jewelers and the silversmiths and the goldsmiths work, and they pan the sewage water. People are required to, in order to, you know, obtain or glean some last little bit of gold dust or silver dust or whatever. This is a place where survival is a grim task, and they're accustomed to working and networking within the relationships that they have. And we've all heard stories about how Indians come in, get involved in HR or hiring or whatever, and they focus on bringing in Indians. But it's not just Indians that do this. I've talked to friends from San Francisco who have dealt with this with the Chinese. In one company that I worked for, I saw the Chinese begin to fill fill in. And this is in the communications and you know, branding, communications, advertising, marketing departments. This happens all over the place. So the idea, you know, this fungible human notion, the fungible individual, it's preposterous. And it I mean, look, even in the trades, which got brought up in sort of behind the scene messages here, the trades have been crushed by this whole thing of allegiance and obligation. You know, it used to be when I was working in carpentry, you know, you have the masons come in the morning and the framers would make fun of them because they'd leave garbage everywhere. And then the framers would be there. Then the electricians would come in as the aristocrats who would complain about how this or that was done. And now you've got, I mean, my brother is a carpenter and the entire world has changed in terms of the trades. It used to be that, again, to this point of fungible humans, and then I'll just shut up. It used to be that there was an implicit thing. A tradesman who was good would walk around with the people he was bringing on. You know, okay, kid like me, I'm carrying these sheets of plywood all day and getting subfloor adhesive on my legs and finding out it's a real pain in the ass to get off, you know. And it used to be that you were like, no, you don't do it that way. Well, why? You know, it's crown up, fool. Don't do jackleg carpentry, you know. And that's gone. So it's not just in the realm of these, you know, social media parentheses, social credit organs that are going to, you know, operate as surveillance tools against us. It's in houses that fall down. It's in crappy engineering. It's in the stuff that we see with the, you know, doors blowing out of planes that have been manufactured based on these. I mean, diversity, equity, and inclusion is basically just a Trojan horse that allows in the same sort of uncle arrangement, the same sort of ethnic allegiance arrangements. And that's perhaps what disgusts me most about this idea of the fungible human and the way in which people like Musk and the even more slimy creature Vivek are trying to push this down our throats.
I'm glad you brought up the trades, Semiogog, because one of the things that has also been gutting the trades is the concept of the shop rocket, which is a tradesman who is primarily oriented in making his employer happy rather than other tradespeople he's working with. So he'll bring power tools to the job if he can afford it and somebody else can't. Because, for example, if you work for a larger company or a union, everybody's issued the tools they need. But if you're in a situation where that doesn't exist for most other workers, but you're wealthy enough to basically have your own private tool shed with you in your truck, you really cut them out. And oftentimes that's also associated with being overly fawning over your boss. It's not the same thing as what we used to call a yellow dog contract, but it's the same mindset. See, the mindset of a yellow dog contract is you sign a contract with the boss on the condition you won't unionize. Now, this isn't contractual. This is what we might call informal social arrangements, but it's the same yellow dog mindset. Oh, I'm going to screw over my fellow tradesmen because I can eke out a little bit more profit here by, you know, pleasing the boss or becoming my own boss and just, you know, kicking down the ladder. So there's that mindset as well.
Certainly when you look at industrial plumbing, carpentry, electricians, all of these trades, what we've seen, especially with carpentry, is you'll have maybe one or two people, usually Hispanic, who are actually from this country or born here, speak English without an accent, but the entire rest of the work crew does not speak a word of English, or at least pretends not to. It's basically taken for granted that you need to know a certain amount of slang Spanish just to get by and just so they don't put one over on you. And what there's very little solidarity between the different trades at this point. Everything is about getting your own little racket done, putting in the maximum amount of hours, and then leaving. And the actual quality of the work, it's almost an irrelevance. There was an article that people were talking about a couple days ago, I think it was on Zero Hedge, India, it's worse than you think. And it talked about how with Indians, the idea of scamming someone or getting one over on someone, that's not a bad thing to do. That's a proof of your cunning, of your intelligence. Mm-hmm. That's what business success is. You actually don't make a good product. You scam someone, and that's the point of the business. A lot of people have noted, even in China, that in the United States with Silicon Valley, if you want to start a new company, you have to actually have something new. In China, you basically duplicate what the other guys have done and then try to crush them through various underhanded means. India, it's even worse. And it's far more serious even than what you're seeing with the illegals and the trades. Because with India, you're dealing with businesses where the sabotage and the poor quality, it's much harder to find on the surface. A lot of people have talked about this when it comes to technology, where you'll bring a problem to their attention and they'll be very servile and they'll agree with you and they'll say they're taking care of it, but they don't actually know what they're talking about. They're just talking to get you to go away. And when they move on to the next thing, that's proof of their success. That's not bad quality work. I feel like there's got to be a way to, I just don't know a way to do it. We're measuring this all wrong, because we can say with confidence that a new house, for example, built today in the United States, usually by illegals, is just not the same quality as a house 100 years ago. In fact, the house 100 years built 100 years ago will probably outlast the $500,000 house built today. But there's not really a way to track that. At least you just got to wait and see what the damage is. The high cost of cheap labor in a lot of these white-collar businesses, it's a lot harder to put our finger on it. How do you track incompetence? How do you track sabotage? How do you track having to redo the code that was made by bad programmers 5 years later because there were all these problems that emerged later? I think one of the big things, and this is before we even get into politics and the externalities of these people who are eventually all going to vote against Musk, regardless of what he says about them now, people like Elon Musk, I think, are being very short-term in their viewpoint with this issue, because it will certainly cut costs in the short term, but the deeper costs are going to be years down the line, because you're building systems that are just not good. And exactly. You're ultimately going to have to spend more to straighten out all these problems that you're creating for yourself. And you're trying to do it within a culture where getting one over on everybody else around you is the goal. There's not even the pretense of work for work's sake or doing a good job, because that's what it means to be an honorable person. I mean, to close with what this article said, it was written by an Indian expatriate, and he said that it took him a while living in England before he even understood what the word honor meant, because in India it was just a meaningless concept.
Good God.
I'm also glad that you brought up that hood, Gregory Hood, because we can talk about the Chinese, we can talk about the Indians, we can talk about all these other immigrants that think like this, but the real problem is there is a core of white men who think like this, and they treat us like that too. I live in a town where the people who run it are these men, these sort of cannibalizing businessmen who bring in Ukrainians and Mexicans to do work. They build a economy around catering to tourists rather than the people here. So these are all, you know, white heritage American men, but they act like these foreigners and they're gutting us. And the problem is, these foreigners couldn't get in if these men didn't already have the power to bring them in, because they are bringing them in to keep the labor costs down. And they also don't care about quality. It's complete garbage. I mean, I see what they do. It's partly job security, because he'll just call you in again to do the work. And it's infuriating, because it's this massive downward pressure that just holds people in place. You can't move. As to your point about housing quality, I would recommend James Howard Kunstler and his Geography to Nowhere. He talks about this a lot. One of the reasons why we've had this housing boom in suburbia is it was one of the ways to give heritage Americans actual work. You know, it does become make work on a long enough time scale, but it's actual physical work, right? So otherwise, if you didn't give them that, they'd riot, right? You don't want to do that. But as you said, the houses are going to start collapsing, the infrastructure is going to start collapsing, and that's in part due to government corporations thinking in terms of quarters. They only think in terms of quarters, because they've developed this financialized matrix to understand reality, and they think, well, reality is just going to conform to this financial schema, which is, of course, no, that's not how reality is going to work. And then I'll just say lastly here, fungibility. This is entirely a result of technology. So let's look at, say, Top Gun with, you know, Tom Cruise flying his jet fighter, the hotshot fighter pilot. Turns out fighter pilots are totally fungible. You can just have an AI drone control other AI drones and fly a whole swarm at another target. Now, we might say, okay, in a very narrowly confined combat experience, yes, a fighter pilot is fungible. A factory worker is fungible because Japan has robot factories. So it's this technological pressure that is being imposed that is reinforcing fungibility. Because prior to technology, people weren't treated as fungible, except maybe as like slaves in like ancient Egypt or Babylon or something. But like in Europe and the West, you know, they weren't treated as the same for all practical purposes. They were seen as having their own unique capacities and capabilities based on a whole variety of different criteria.
Right, but kind of the entire underpinnings of liberal progressivism is the idea that we are fungible, like on a global scale. Like this is part of the reason why nations themselves are kind of held to be racist concepts and why we can't have them. To tie it way back to what people were discussing earlier, so a nation is obviously a specific group of people, and that tends to be, you know, one, maybe two races, but in any event, it's a specific people, right? And the idea that we have to look out for this specific group of people is in conflict with this leftist idea that, you know, all these people out here are actually the same as us, or they could be the same as us if they only came here and, you know, assimilated to our you know, whatever our ideology is supposed to be as America these days. And like what's become exposed here, and which we already knew, but it's really exposed, is that a lot of the tech right holds this to be true. Like they do think we're largely fungible. You know, maybe there's some exceptional people anywhere in the world, but you know, they are ultimately the same as American people. And so if we bring them here, it's not a problem. We want to keep them out. That's you know, revanchist racism from these weird Americans that we don't like. We're starting to have questions about being part of. But I think that's a lot of what's driving this underlying conflict here, is that they don't really think of nations the way that we do. I mean, obviously, but it's still tied to this leftist idea of the interchangeability of everyone on the planet.
They don't think of Western nations the way we do. I think other nations that are non-Western sometimes get more respect, right?
Right, and the other thing that's quite interesting, one of the ideas being propagated by the tech bros and all this other stuff is this internally contradictory idea of colorblind meritocracy. And the reason that that's internally contradictory is just because different nations, different peoples value things differently. And this is very obvious. If that wasn't the case, every nation would turn out the same because everyone valued the same things in the same way. You can just look around and see that this isn't the case. And to that end, I have an excerpt from the British government in India about 100 years ago or so. Actually, it might have been more, but I'm in the 1870s. And I would just like to read it to illustrate why it is that this colorblind so-called meritocracy could very well end up biting the tech bros in the butt just because they have the colorblind aspect. And this is one of the British officers observed this, and he says, "On the railways of India, it has been found that the great increase of pay which has taken place has neither augmented the rapidity of execution nor added to the comfort of the laborer. The Hindu workman knows no other want than his daily portion of rice, and the torrid climate renders watertight habitations and ample clothing alike unnecessary. The laborer therefore desists from work as soon as he has provided for the necessities of the day. Higher pay adds nothing to his comforts. It serves but to diminish his ordinary industry." So this is something that's quite interesting to me. The British showed up in India and assumed that work would function the same way with a completely different people, a different nation, and therefore they could just up the wages and the workers would do better. But they found the exact opposite. They'd up the wages and the workers decided they had better things to do than work now that everything's been taken care of, and so they could just quit. This isn't colorblind noticing this. This is a British officer noticing these different peoples value things differently than we do, and this has had negative consequences on how we've ran our industries. I do think that regardless of the intentions, I don't think that Musk is some sinister mastermind in a boardroom talking about how he can dupe the Anons on Twitter with this stuff and then pull the rug out from under them. I think he does, in some degree, truly believe in this colorblind meritocracy. But this is even more short-term and perhaps less fixable than all the other problems that have been raised, because I don't know that this pattern has changed. I don't know that if you keep providing more things for these different populations, if they won't just quit for the day now that their needs have been met. I mean, there are certainly an overabundance of anecdotes of them just not finishing work and lying about their completion and forcing other people on their teams or whatever else to finish the work for them. In fact, the pattern seems to be there by my reckoning, but maybe someone else has a better read on the situation.
So there are two tangible racial differences there between Indians and whites, which are, one of them is a concept of honor and wanting to do your best and all that, be a man of your word. And another is a drive to exert yourself and to work and, you know, to the dignity of labor, so to speak. Neither of those drives seems to be present there. Which, it, you know, if you thought that all people were the same, as I think someone like Elon Musk might well be naive or autistic enough to think, then you're in for a nasty shock.
Well, I think
this also gets into religious differences between us. It's one thing if you're importing fellow Christians, and even for people in the United States who aren't Christians, like Elon Musk, they live their entire lives under Christian assumptions, you know, things like thou shalt not steal. And these idiot liberals, they don't comprehend that these people from China or from India fundamentally do not have a problem stealing from other ethnic groups, the same way that white people have issues with stealing from people. Like, even if they're not Christians, this is so deeply embedded in people's like biospirit. They don't understand that these ethnic groups have fundamentally different assumptions about right and wrong, and that they will simply scam you and steal from you and lie about the work they're doing. And it would, you know, especially if you are a Christian, you know, you're terrified of this sort of blatant theft. You would never countenance doing something like this on purpose, but they're just not like this.
Well, Gregory, you were saying, and I mean, if I nodded my head any more emphatically, I would have broken my own neck, because everything you were saying reflects with everything I've encountered in my years of immigration, my years in law enforcement, everything. And this also goes back to what Colin was saying, what Ryan was saying, and a couple of the other fellows, I believe Semiagog was also saying, about the general decline of society. And that, remember, these people are coming here to the United States and opening businesses. The visas they use are generally E1 visas, E2 visas, things like that. And that is their whole precept, to not provide a better service, not to provide good quality items to the community, but to scam you, to rob you, and to cheat you. And to go back to something that a few of the other gentlemen were talking about, this is why I was saying that we are not a team, because we're not even approaching the game the same way. Colin and I could get on a team, and we're going to more or less see one another eye to eye. As he said, you know, we value labor, we value honor. Now, he's going to have some of his ways of doing things, because he's a different man than I am, a different country, a different nation, but we're largely going to agree. However, you put me on the same team as a Han Chinese or a Hindi, it's just not going to work. We're going to approach the game in entirely different methods. There is no possible way we are going to play similarly. And to kind of go to what Charlemagne said, and I agree emphatically, we're approaching them at such different levels, in such different ways, from such different perspectives. I might even be appalled by the way these other people approach the game. To continue the team metaphor, I might actually be offended to my very core into how this game is being approached. So how any of this is supposed to work, why anybody believes any of this could work, is just patently absurd to me. And I hate to go to this line, because I know we all laugh at it, we all roll our eyes, but it really does have some merit. And the line is, well, the libs are the real racists. But in a way they are, because they think every difference between humanity is merely ornamental, that there is no possible deeper difference between any of us. There couldn't be any sort of environmental, social factors that made us inherently, and I like your term, Charlie, the biospirited, differently biospirited. I'll use that phrase. They just act like that's not possible. And it's just patently absurd.
If that's the view of the progressive, then what is the view of the tech bro? Because that's, I think, becoming relevant suddenly.
Well,
it raises.
To answer that, this statement is kind of one of those what urban legend statements. I think it was attributed to Mark Twain once. But it says, it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it. So what I would want to say about Elon Musk is he's not stupid. We all know that. So any explanation that he's doing this because he's stupid is wrong. It's likely he's not misinformed, because with the internet now, I think everything we know, Musk knows. I also don't think Musk is a Fu Manchu mustache twirling villain either. I think what Musk is a businessman, and he has economic interests. Now, we all might here push against the concept of homo economicus. But if you get that big in the Wall Street and bourgeoisie, that's all you think about. You eat, sleep, and breathe that. There's nothing else that exists. If you read, for example, American Prosperity by Paul Mazur, he views the market as a divine expression of God. Like, he really talks about markets like that, as some sort of embedded process of reality that's divine. And this was like the 1920s. And it's all, and you can read literature like that. Now, they might not talk like that now in public, because America is less Christian than it was then, and so they don't use as much Christian-y language. But I think the explanation with the most explanatory power is that Elon Musk does believe in this homo economicus, and the only thing that matters for him is the bottom line. And that means driving the cost of wages down, because tech bros are expensive. And you're going to have a graph, right, where there's the rising cost of tech bros and then the cost of the sales. And if the sales dip and the cost of tech bros goes up, your business is gone. So they're going to do everything in their power to prevent that line from getting crossed.
I think analyzing what the tech bros think and the way they view humanity is one question. But one thing we should keep in mind, especially with all the many, many mask off moments that we got from Indians over the last couple of days, and I'm sure you gentlemen all have examples, is you're really seeing acceptable racial nationalism from non-white groups. And I say racial nationalism because all the arguments that people like us would make about how these policies are bad for America very quickly turn into, yes, and that's why we need more Indian immigration. This is revenge for the $45 trillion. That's the figure that Indians always throw around with the British Raj, the $45 trillion that the Anglosphere stole from India. Your women are rejecting you. You're not having kids. There was actually an engineer at Musk's own X, which taunted white people and basically said, you've done nothing. I've done everything. You're not even having kids. You're a disgrace to your ancestors. And Musk defended him. Now, if it was a white person who said that, not only would that person lose their job, it's very likely that you'd have a federal civil rights investigation. But we all know that it's not even an issue with this. Very often we talk about the ideology of economic man, or say that everybody just sees people as pure inputs. But what we actually see, I think there are very – this is one of my little sayings, and I'd like to hear you guys take this on because I could be wrong. I think there are actually very few – progressives. I think 99.9% of people support racial nationalism for somebody, and probably close to 100% of non-whites. And even the people who don't support it for their own, I don't think Elon Musk has some implicit white nationalism or something like that. He clearly sees no problem with other people doing this kind of program, or even someone like Richard Hanania. He speaks in terms of defending Indian community interests. It doesn't even occur to him, or maybe it does, but he just understands where his bread is buttered, that this kind of resettlement in Israel, for example, would be a complete non-starter because they're allowed to do certain things and we are not. And we're sort of chasing our own tail, because I feel that if white people actually were the racists, the tribalists, the the ethnic separatists that they're always accusing us of being, a lot of these people who are accusing us of being racist would actually reconcile themselves to our pursuit of our collective interest, because they seem to take that for granted with everybody else. Really, maybe what we're facing is not so much a progressive doctrine of everybody's just an economic input, but you've got moderate right-wing forces like us essentially being stomped by far more ethnocentric far-right forces being mobilized on behalf of other groups.
Woes, we have Dave Distributist in the back room.
Ah, thank you.
Yeah, but we have him briefly. That's what I was learning. Dave, if you haven't been hearing, we've been talking about, obviously, the H-1B Christmas war.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I'm calling to you from the road, so I just have a 10 or 20 minutes just to say hello, and thanks, Millennial Woes, for putting on the streamies you do every year. The H-1B, that's a very interesting thing, though. This has been a fascinating 24 hours on Twitter. I mean, it really just underlines the picture, especially the Vivek tweet. That's going to go down in political history in America for a very, very long time, because it's just so rare that you see the sort of revenge of the nerds. It's not even really an ethnic thing. It's much more the sort of revenge of the nerds Reddit economic capitalist maximalist right there. And then it's obvious how the ideology kind of collapses in on itself.
I mean, I think it's somewhat, it's both racialized and not racialized. It is what you said, but I do think there's also like an Asian, meaning both East Asian and South Asian Indian here, element of, you know, like this very tiger mom upbringing that, you know, when I was reading that tweet, like the more I thought about it, the more I was, and I'm warm toward Vivek, obviously less so after all this stuff, but I tended to be pretty sympathetic to him. But the more I thought about that tweet, I was like, this in no way reflected like my upbringing as a, you know, a random white kid. It is, I don't know if I knew a single white person who was raised like this. Whereas, you know, I did know some Asian
kids. That's the thing, isn't it? Right. Like, this is the tiger mother mentality. And we know how this works out. This is called South Korea. Like, you can go there, you can visit it. Is South Korea booming because of this mentality that they'll grind everything down just to get the economic benefit in the short term? It's really obvious that, you know, to the extent that libertarianism has its points, it has to exist under a substrate of core values. And this whole idea that we're just going to like jam this nerd culture economic maximalism is as hard as possible. And if you don't, you're a loser. It just kind of collapses in on itself. You can see the people who have tried this and it doesn't work for them.
I'd also bring
it's
up.
All, it's also the case. I'll just say real quick. It's also the case that he's just outright wrong about the whole jock versus nerd separation. Like, if I think back to my 11th and 12th grade high school classes, you know, something like 50% of the AP classes were literal football team players and cheerleaders. So it's just bullshit. But anyway,
John Carter did a really good tweet about it, summarizing all of this. And one of the things he said was that Vivek Ramaswamy's distinction, but distinguishing between those two things, the jock and the nerd, that itself showed a misunderstanding of white people, because we don't necessarily see those as mutually exclusive. It's perfectly very common for the, I mean, I think of these American high school cliches of the top guy in sports is also an ace student. He is an academic or whatever. So whereas this Asian mindset is to specialize. So
the Faustian man has always been the combination of the spirit and the temple. That was the Greek ideal. That was the Christian ideal. That has always been a core element of Faustian civilization. And all of our greatest innovators have been people who have had a background that has combined either a military and sports with an intellectual excellence. You can't have one without the other. This is the division of the two. Well, I mean, it comes from these sort of nerd movies from the 70s. But that, you know, that itself, you could say, is sort of a non-Western perspective. And I won't elaborate.
Mm.
Yeah, right. It betrays, like, a uniquely, like, the priest caste that the Viveks come from. You know, these are not athletic people. They don't have a history here. As like you just mentioned, you know, dating back to the Greeks and before that, it was a fusion of physical activity. Like, all of these philosophers were Jack Chads, you know. There wasn't some separation of these two things. They were supposed to feed each other. So it's an alien mindset that exposed itself in those tweets there.
Or the other priest class that might have been that. Never mind.
Well this is how the various things they've got in common, though. You know, it's interesting.
I am very glad that we're talking about castes now, because this is something I've not seen anyone else bring up, which is that the unstated ideal from the tech bro types is that this middle caste of engineers and scientists and whomever else, people that were traditionally the middle of Western society or Faustian society, the aristocrats, the polymaths, the not people that weren't only engineers or scientists, these people that didn't have monomaniacal focus into one topic, the aristocrats were always on top, the engineers and the scientists were always in the middle. No one has yet countered this idea that the engineers and the scientists should be on top. I am certain that someone can pull out some Spenglerian analysis, one of you guys on the panel, because I'm about to have to go, about what would happen if we artificially elevated this middle caste and supplanted the aristocrats, the lords, the war makers, and whomever else that rightfully does rule with scientists and engineers.
Isn't that exactly what we're seeing here with the tech bros?
The point being, though, that it's not a bug, it's a feature, not to put too ironic a point on it, given the industry that we're talking about. From the as was just pointed out, you know, from the Greco-Roman mind-body ideal all the way up through the idea of the Renaissance man, or indeed the intelligence officer, somebody like a Richard Burton, you know, who spoke, you know, however many languages and went in disguise to Mecca and also, you know, was skilled with map making and all the rest, you know, the kind of skills that you see laid out in Kipling's book Kim. Mm-hmm. You know, this idea of this individual who exists between worlds, and basically this goes back to these Western ideas of individualism, let's say rightly construed rather than the negative aspects that we've all had to deal with. There is a certain class, or there are castes, coming back to like the Reddys in India. You know, the castes are supposed to do given things. You're not going to see, as was just touched upon, Kshatriyas, you know, getting too tangled up in the areas that the Brahmins have within their control. The idea is that these things are supposed to be distributed throughout society in certain ways so that each people gets to, you know, take care of their uncle. Whereas we have this idea that there's going to be a certain category of person that is really the highest product of our society. And that person is going to be destined for great things because of the ways that human interests and spheres of activity overlap in their Venn diagram. That is what makes them unique. And so when I say it's not a bug, it's a feature, I'm going back, like if you look at Quigley's The Anglo-American Establishment, it's actually back at the house and I'm out in the office, so I can't pull some of the quotes that I wanted to from it. But there's quite a bit of back and forth and discussion that's going on in the correspondence, and I guess what you would today call the white papers of things like the Round Table and the rest, where they're talking about what sort of person is most appropriate to act as an imperial functionary. And I think that the answer they settled upon is quite clear when you see the way in which the so-called colored populations have been distributed by the Brits through the various parts of their empire. And we don't need to get into the question now of whether or not the United States was targeted for reabsorption at some point, and whether or not that indeed happened during what we call the Great Rapprochement and the Gilded Age. But the point is that with corporate structures, they're fundamentally a military structure, as we have with all hierarchical structures. And so do you want something that is more the Asiatic approach which we even see, it is claimed, with the Russian military structure today, where you have a command class that wants to make sure that they operate from the top, ensuring that everything gets done in line with their policies and the rest? Or do you want to go with what was historically like the Prussian model of officers with individual initiative? There's a risk that comes with individual initiative. A real risk, because these are people who are working their way up through the ranks. I mean, look what happens with a Corsican, you know, artilleryman. You can run into real problems with initiative. And in the past, one of the real problems with a heavy top-down arrangement, your corporate structure, your national structure, your military structure, was a lack of information and a delay when input comes from your feelers out in the field, whether it's through signal flags or, you know, smoke signals or flares being fired into the sky or radio, a delay between when the corporate organism encounters something that it needs to deal with and it coming back up the chain to the hierarchy for the decision to be made. Well, real communism hasn't been tried. And I think the as we all know, of course, and I think the reason that this heavy granular control of everything that happens in society, it hasn't been tried till now. These guys think that they can really do it now because they do have the granular input with the short amount of delay time. And so there's no reason to encourage individual initiative in the ranks beneath those that command, because they can sort of sit in their war room in the center. And so the it's not a bug, it's a feature, middle management creature that well, that certain types of people from Asia seem to excel in being, that type of person really comes into their own. I think there's an argument that they want this type of person. You know, when I've ever had to do like sales and the rest with corporations, you know, an old friend of mine back in the day said, in any organization, there are 99 people who can say no and one who can say yes. And that's that top-down structure. I think that's how they want it. And these sort of middling functionaries are precisely the ones that, well, certainly the British Empire made a bet on a long time ago as the best sort of middle manager class to export around the world, to Madagascar, to South Africa, you know, what have you. And that's precisely the group that we're seeing brought in for what, you know, the normies think of as top positions, like being in charge of Google, but they're really middle management positions where they're most concerned that these people do precisely what they're told.
Although they'll never admit it, that they'll never admit this, but the ruling class does view things this way. They do view Asian immigrants as a much more controllable population than the white natives. They'll never say that, but you can sense from people talking that they believe that they'll be much more conducive to social changes.
To your point, Dave, that was the whole point of the Whole Foods heat map. If it's all white men, they're going to start a union, so you better diversify it. But there's another thing here. A bunch of guys have mentioned how, with the Greek ideal, there was both the physical training and the mental training. And I think if we want to like describe this in like mythic terms, we could say, if we look at the Philosopher's Stone, which geometrically is represented as a circle, which contains a triangle, which contains a square, which contains a circle. The inner circle represents the union of reason and emotion, which could be seen as the body and the mind. So the jock and the nerd dichotomy is a dividing line that was drawn between that so they don't come together and integrate. If we look at alchemy as a primitive psychology, like Carl Jung did, as well as a primitive chemistry, we get the name chemistry from alchemy, we can view what we're talking about now as the primitive chemistry form of alchemy defeating the primitive psychology form of alchemy in the financial and scientific revolutions. I believe now we're beginning to see a possible resurgence of the psychology side of alchemy, which can win. In fact, I would actually argue that World War I, which if we use Ernst Jünger's distinction that technology is the metaphysic of the 20th century, was a kind of holy war by the alchemical party that represented chemistry against the alchemical party that represented psychology or mental science. And a lot of people who might have represented that mental science were killed in the trenches, which just completely decapitated any attempt at building it. For example, the storyist William Hope Hodgson, talks about a kind of mental science in terms of a spiritual detective and so on. But he's killed in World War One. And then even if you survive, you have the sort of mental destruction in the trenches. So I think this is sort of a recasting everything in mythic terms.
Well, Dave, do you have anything to add to this before you have to go? I'm just thinking about, because this H-1B thing, I'd love to hear your general thoughts about that, because it's obviously a huge issue.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think this has been, the discourse has certainly been a victory for the right. This is something that it's very obvious that the Vivek Elons have lost, not the least of which because now it's firmly established that H-1B visas does not refer to elite human capital. this is a middle class visa application. There's a separate visa class for the individual geniuses that are sponsored by high paying institutions by name. This is not designed to be a genius, get the geniuses into your country type deal. And just across the board, it's really, really obvious that the really like the shitlibs have lost this one, both the neocon shitlibs and the progressive shitlibs. Even the far leftists are taking the piss out of the moderate shitlibs right now. It's really quite amazing. And if nothing else, I really hope this is going to be the beginning of the end for the elite human capital people that we saw emerging in like 2024. I'm not to go after anyone here, but you know, there's sort of a contingent of the right wing that tried to play up this technocratic dimension, and I really think that's not very well suited for our age. The second it gets into dialogue, it just kind of collapses in on itself. And you see this again and again with the Richard Hanania types of the world, of various other people who've kind of followed in his path. And I'm not going to name names, but I just think this is a dead end for the right wing. Politics is about loyalty, and just praising wealth and power doesn't tell me who you're loyal to fundamentally. I have no idea who Vivek is loyal to. Supposedly there's something he fights for that he wouldn't give up for more money, but I don't know what that is.
Maybe I can Dave up for some commentary on this, because I know we both work in tech. In my experience working in tech, I've been exposed to these Indian teams before. And in my case, when one gets hired, there is basically this Brahmin, effectively, who's in charge of all of them. And when Indians are hired, it's usually in bulk, and they're all sort of attached to this single sort of manager who is the middleman between everyone else and all of the people. So in normal cases, in computer programming, if I have some problem or something that needs to be resolved, I'd go talk to another fellow developer, and you'd sort of hash it out on an individual level and come up with the best solution. But when I tried to do the same thing with some of these Indians who came in, they basically like wouldn't talk to you. And also their manager, who wasn't formally necessarily in charge of them, would sort of instantly butt in and try and keep you from talking to his people. All problems had to be funneled through him. And it completely disrupts how Western corporate activity functions, where it very highly values individual contributors and proactive problem solving, kind of how Western militaries are organized around the NCO. Do you have any experience with this sort of thing, Dave?
I mean, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've certainly been in tech for a very long time. There definitely is a huge bimodal distribution in South Asians, where there is definitely sort of the elite South Asian experience that we saw more in the early 2000s and the 90s. That was very, very different from just a lot of the South Asians that are coming in now. It does suggest kind of a caste distinction here. And there is sort of a tendency that when companies become too dominated by South Asians, they go into that mode of group thing that you referred to. That is a very common experience. But I don't know. I'm less concerned about how they function inside corporations. I'm more concerned about how the South Asian vote is going to function inside as a political block. Presumably, you know, some of them will need to be kind of put into the coalition of sanity at some stage. And the question is, are they going to be cohesive like the African-Americans, in which case they will be a huge problem? Or can some of them kind of be incorporated into something that seems more reasonable and more rational, discussing what the demographics of the West is going to look like, presumably with, you know, not the entire subcontinent of India moving here?
I think they're most likely to vote as they're told.
Well, certainly the newer ones are, but you know, that would kind of buck the highly bimodal nature of South Asian populations generally, to function as very distinguishably two kinds of people. But I don't want to end my time on talking about South Asians, which I only know from working with them in tech. And I just wanted to comment generally on the fact that I think that this is a victory, and that I think that we're going to see a new forum of discourse and dialectics emerge on the right wing in 2025. And I hope that this kind of dialectics we see is a foreshadowing of things to come, and that we can take this and use it to organize for bigger and better things in 2025.
Yeah, I agreed with Dave. I think the one of the things that struck me about the response to Elon is how unapologetic it was. There was no backing down, no being cowed by being called racist or whatever. No matter what tricks they pulled out and threw, people just kept making their points, kept making really solid points.
Well, it's so hard to cow people. Like, people tried to cow me for, I am a little bit of a racial reconciliationist, so to speak, as everyone knows. But it's so hard to get cowed for being a racist when all these Indians are just heaping on the most brilliant yes. anti-white stuff imaginable. I don't fucking care anymore, right? Like, yeah. you can't be anti-white and expect me to care about respecting the superiority of Indian people who haven't even moved here yet. It's ridiculous. Like, and I think all of white America kind of realized that at this stage. It's just, you know, this is all bullshit. They'll turn around and say any number of bad things about your race with the drop of a hat.
Yeah, that's my point. These guys make me look like a leftist in terms of like racial nationalism. I mean, this was sort of my point.
Yeah, apparently the Indians are also like much of leftist to be racist too, right?
I mean, the amount of cover that Elon Musk specifically provided the Indian engineer who attacked white people as a group, I think, was the most revealing exchange of this entire thing. Because I mean, and this goes to something that Jared Taylor always talks to me about, you know, because one of the things that can be frustrating sometimes with my job, with what I do, is sometimes you sort of feel like you're saying the same things over and over again. Like, did you know that there are IQ differences between different racial groups? Like, once you've said that for about 10 years, you want to talk about something else. But one thing that you kind of have to keep doing that. But one thing that always wakes people up, always, the most consistent genre is the double standards. Because when you see someone say something like that, and then you see a white person, an extremely powerful white person, provide cover for that, and then in the next breath go after white people specifically, it throws the whole moral framework into contention. And I think that by itself has done a huge amount to shift the Overton window.
So yeah, pointing out hypocrisy actually helps, Gregory.
Pointing out the double standard, the fact that, I mean, this is something where I disagree with Jared sometimes, but like one of the things that we kind of go back and forth sometimes, good naturedly, I might add, is I will say things like, look, these people aren't saying this argument in good faith. Like, they don't believe this. Nobody believes this. This is obviously just a cover for their individual interests or the collective racial interests. And he'll say, no. Like, this is all in good faith. You need to treat their arguments respectfully, that they actually say what they mean. But when you see something like that exchange, like with this exchange with the ex-engineer, I keep calling it Twitter, and Elon Musk, as all of you have been pointing out, Elon Musk is many things, but he is not a stupid man. He clearly understands what's happening here, but he just finds it acceptable for some people and unacceptable for other people. In fact, even as we're sitting here talking, a lot of people are being purged off X right now as we speak. I kind of wonder if I'll have an account when we're done here.
Just pointing that out is just showing it, not commenting on it.
You just point it out and that's it. But you don't need to do the, well, actually, our principles show that you shouldn't do this. I think that's where conservatives get it wrong.
Yeah, Gregory, you said that he finds it acceptable for some and unacceptable for others. I think that's actually driven by his own personal needs. So what's expedient for him at the time? And it's expedient for him now to call white people racist when they moan about being replaced. But it's expedient for him to defend Indians being smug about replacing whites, because they're working for him. They're going to be working for him. Or in case of that one you mentioned, actually is working for him. By the way, that person is, I believe, half Indian and half Jewish. So, you know, double strength there. Dave, do you need to go? Because I don't want you to.
I do, but yeah, I think it is interesting. Elon should be treated as not an enemy or not a friend. He has his own agenda. He will always go in his own agenda. He's a loose cannon. We just have to respect that, right? And so, you know, but that being said, thank you guys for having me on. I have to run. I really appreciate Millennial this year, Woz, and good luck with the rest of it.
Well, thank you very much. And we're all glad you can make a cameo appearance here.
Thank you.
All right.
Gentlemen, if you don't mind as well, I also have to run. So thank you, Mr. Woz. It was very enjoyable.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad you were able to appear.
Yes, me too. And yeah, look forward to talking to you all soon. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye, Ryan.
Just to piggyback off something Distributors was saying there, I was pretty, like, you know, at first I was kind of disheartened about the schism and the ferocity of it. Like, you know, oh no, we're going to have a falling out with a tech right who has been really useful in some ways. But I mean, I think what it did expose is how Twitter has turned our guys into, like, we're the people of Arrakis after all that we've been through, like under Jack and I forget the Indians, Perig, was that his name? Like, after all the censorship that we have endured over the years has, like, not only strengthened the arguments that we're able to put forth, but has, like, strengthened our resolve to the point where, you know, no one cares about being called a racist. So that's a total non-starter of an argument amongst us. Like, these people, all these people I'm seeing going out there, totally undaunted by these accusations that used to be able to cow, you know, your average Republican. But now it's just like these guys are out there just shrugging these things off. And, you know, the political environment that we've gone through over the last, what, 8 or 9 years has just forged, like, a new character of, like, right-wing soldier that is just really exciting to see when stuff like this unfolds.
God created Twitter to train the faithful.
Well, so this is an interesting part of it that we haven't really touched on, that Elon Musk is apparently what do you call it? There must be a specific term for this type of de-boosting. He's removing people's blue badges or whatever, and disabling them from premium, and also unsubscribing all their subscribers, which is a thing that you can do with premium, I believe. So he's really, I mean, it's so petty and transparent and obvious that I'm sort of amazed. But I guess it's like an autistic kid just throwing all his toys away because, I don't know, it feels like it's so obvious that someone with more social skill wouldn't do it. And
well,
I know
also,
the previous administration did it, but that was a different thing. That this is going to come down on Musk personally. So I think it's interesting. Sorry, Charlemagne.
Oh, I was just going to say it's so petty. I kind of suspect that there's a certain ethnic block of people who actually do the moderation who might be making these decisions rather than Musk, although he certainly might not have a problem with it. So I think we need to see how it shakes out. I wouldn't assume that Musk is personally removing blue checks and things like that, or reducing their or canceling their premium subscribers. Maybe he is. I don't know. I don't want to, but I wouldn't jump the gun on that necessarily, because, you know, we know who's working at X, right? And we know kind of how these people react to any insinuation that there are certain issues with their ethnicity, right? So there could be something else going on there. I do want to add, too, on what Dave was saying on his way out, that Musk definitely has his own interests that sometimes align and sometimes don't with Donald Trump and our interests as well. And it would be great if we can maintain him as an ally on our side. I think right now it's quite obvious that Musk is very slowly trying to walk back some of the stronger points he's made. I've noticed he's deleted some of his tweets calling people subtards. He's been sort of narrowing down the type of immigration he wants. I think if possible, if we could offer him sympathetic but uncompromising takes, that is the path forward right now. He's clearly tilted and completely, you know, spurging out, basically. But we don't want to just infuriate him if possible. At this point, if there's a way to extend olive branches without compromising our positions, that's what we should be doing right now, because this is a very powerful person that we want to keep within Trump's coalition, especially given, as we've seen over the last few months, the type of other opposition Trump has against him from the GOP, the same people who ruined his first administration. So we really don't want to lose Musk if possible. And we definitely at this point don't want to be provoking him any more than is necessary.
Yeah, this is politics, right? This is coalition, finding somebody who has some overlapping interests. They don't agree with everything with you, but you can find enough points of agreement to work together on certain issues, right? This is where we move beyond sniping on the internet to the real political game, right? Trying to make provisional friends.
Right. And in this case, it's like part of the point of fracture is that, you know, Elon Musk is just more of a globalist than we are. He has a lot of international friends. A lot of these, you know, people are immigrants. He himself is an immigrant. Like, he doesn't have the same perspective as, you know, someone who's got generations and generations of American blood in them. And that's just a fact on the ground that we're going to have to work with, to the extent that he remains an important part of the coalition. So, you know, it doesn't even offend me that he believes some of these things. It's really not that surprising, but, you know, it is something that we should approach. You know, I love the shitposting and, you know, people mass dogpiling him and stuff, and that's part of the process too, but part of our coalition is definitely going to have to be, you know, sort of having softer hands towards some of these people. Because I don't think Musk is an enemy. Like, I think he really is an ally. There's going to be these points of departure, and maybe if it was just our coalition and his coalition is the last two on Earth, then we might be enemies. But that's a long ways off. So I think this is just a momentary break that, you know, that we can smooth over in time and probably come out on the politically correct, pardon the unintentional pun there, but the correct side of the politics on.
The thing is, though, it does seem to me that this is a fairly fundamental disagreement. I mean, it's not like we need to get him to understand that, something trivial. This is a massive thing. You're saying we need to try to get him to understand that nations matter to people. He's in his 50s and he hasn't realized this yet. And I understand he hasn't. I understand, but he does and he just doesn't care. You know, he's a nowhere person. He's a globalist, massive billionaire, and an immigrant, and I think he's got three different citizenships or something. How are you going to get someone like that to take seriously the idea of a working class man who can't compete with the whole world, but deserves a living wage anyway? How can you get someone like Elon Musk to understand and agree with that?
You don't. You say you're not the king. Trump is. You're a part of this coalition. You don't own it. We don't care what you think about nations. You don't get to decide that our nation is going to be eradicated. So it's not about convincing him to believe what we do. It's about demonstrating resoundingly that he doesn't get to make the decisions here. Americans do.
Well said.
And just to hammer that point about the importance of this, the fundamental importance of this, just briefly, this is the guy, along with Greasy Vivek, who is going to be put, we are told, in charge of this, you know, informal office to improve government efficiency. And the first thing he comes with out of the gate, I mean, before Trump is even inaugurated, is another one of these, you know, riffs about how we have to bring in these people from Asia and elsewhere, because it's just more efficient. And that's how America wins. America wins, whatever America is at this point, by bringing these people in. So just again, to underscore what Woz was just saying, this is the crux, the fulcrum, what have you. So I certainly don't disagree with Charlemagne. In fact, I do very much agree with him that you catch more flies with honey. I'm just not the person to do that. Having spent time on this debilitating platform, it just makes me so damned angry. I guess we should stop and celebrate the fact that we do have this opportunity to engage with the guy who is in charge of this platform and say what it is we think, because we have not thus far had this opportunity to directly say this to him. So yeah, you catch more flies with honey, but this matters.
Yeah, I really appreciate someone pointed out that this is a conversation that we wouldn't be having if Trump had lost the election, right? So this is a good problem to be having this conversation, because the alternative is we don't even get to argue about it. It's just they're going to shove it down our throats good and hard, and we have no room to maneuver. We have room to maneuver. Trump is sympathetic to the anti-mass immigration cause, right? I think it looks like Vance is signaling the same way. You know, we have an opportunity here that we wouldn't have had. So, you know, don't get too black-pilled.
We also wouldn't be having this conversation if Jack Dorsey were still president of Twitter, or CEO.
Exactly. Yeah, right.
But I've had a bit of a long day. I think I'm going to knock off too. But I appreciate the invitation, Woz, and it was wonderful talking to all you gentlemen tonight. So have a great rest of your year.
Oh, thank you very much. Praise of folly.
Same to you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Oh yeah, there is definitely an irony here that, like as he said, if Jack or Perig was still in charge, this conversation would never be taking place. So it's like Elon bought Twitter, turned it into a free speech platform, and now we're just dunking all over him. I mean, it's
that might be ending even as we speak. There's a lot of purging going on, like right now, apparently. So we'll see. I mean, what he just said during one of these spaces is something along the lines of like racism is not to be considered free speech, and that'll result in a permanent ban. I'm going to need to find the full context, but now that the election's over, the brief window of opportunity we had may be fading. That said, beggars can't be choosers. And I think that He's put himself so far out there as the guy for free speech that it's going to be very difficult for him to go back to, actually, I can just ban anybody I want for whatever arbitrary reason I want. And I also question whether legally he's going to be able to do it, because, I mean, we sued Twitter years ago under the old management and got through a couple rounds of litigation because under the old terms of her service, it guaranteed freedom of speech. And the courts found that compelling. And ultimately, there was some weird technical arbitration thing that is why we couldn't go any farther. But Musk has put himself out there on so many things that I think if he tries to shut people down in this clumsy and blatant manner, it may work to his disadvantage in ways that he hasn't predicted yet.
Yeah, and also it's not like Elon Musk has an overflowing reservoir of allies to draw from. He's pretty tied to the Trump camp. And if significant people in the Trump camp, like Miller and Vance particularly, are signaling in the other direction, you know, if he wants to just go off on his own, you know, fine. But then the Justice Department might be able to, you know, do whatever they want with his platform. So he needs to stick to Trump's agenda, whatever that agenda ends up being. Hopefully it ends up friendlier to us than what Musk is proposing, and signs point to that being the case. But yeah, it's not like he has a lot of other friends he can turn to at the moment. So he really does need to manage his relationship with the incoming administration very carefully here.
Well, to what extent are we sure that Trump and the incoming administration are at odds with the tech bros on this?
I don't think we know for sure. I do think they are, because we have seen Trump fairly recently say something about, you know, stapling green cards to graduates' chests and things. But, headphone just popped out. But I don't think that he's anywhere near the kind of
immigration maximalists that a lot of people like, you know, Nick Fuentes's camp try to make him out to be. I think he's still, so during his first administration, he successfully cut every form of mass migration into the United States, including even the pro-business stuff, which he was softest on. And so I wouldn't see that reversing under his second term, especially when he ran on even more explicitly on a campaign of outright deportation, which is, you know, it's still kind of shocking to think about that he won on a platform of mass deportations. And I just find it very difficult to imagine that he's going to turn into, you know, a sort of libertarian Koch brothers, invite the world into our borders because that's how we keep the economy running.
I mean, we can also, I can't reveal specific details, but I will say some of us know for sure that people very close to Trump and within his sphere of influence are directly tuned into some of the people you'd regard as, you know, dissonant broadcasters, whatever. So our message is reaching them. And I could say that with 100% certainty. So it's not like we are just throwing shots in the dark here and have no idea what's going on. We have real reason to believe that these people are at least listening to some of us actively and that the message is getting there.
Yeah, actually, to that point, I heard from someone who has an inside source that, you know, the internal debate inside Trump's camp does favor us. It's not a complete victory, but it's breaking our way.
Well, I mean, that's nice. It's good. It's encouraging to hear that. To me, this seems to, as I said at the start, it seems to have illuminated a whole area of the way that the powerful view society today, as simply as an economic zone and a nation as a sports team, and because it opens up this whole thing. Okay, so what about the people who can't compete? I mean, what do you do with the citizens who aren't economically viable? It's a way of looking at society that is just deeply anti-human by default, I think. So
I saw a tweet where somebody said, do we deport the underperforming people? You know, kick them out of the nation because they're not contributing enough to the economy.
Exactly. I mean, it's a terrible way, and I think just again, it's just very anti-ethnos. It's the mentality that wants a diverse workforce because they're less likely to unionize. You know, this the stuff we saw with Amazon a few years ago, and just sees man as an economic unit.
Yeah.
And it's something that we've moaned about for a long time, and the left moaned about it for decades before that. It's ironic. You know, I think that there are people on the left who are now smug about like the likes of us, and they're saying you fell for Elon Musk, you fell for Trump. These men are just capitalists. They're just evil right-wing capitalist demagogues who seduced the man, like Nigel Farage over here as well. The left say the same thing about him, probably correctly. And I guess this sort of illuminates our unique predicament as people who are fundamentally right-wing and yet see these problems with that we have sympathies with the left in some ways.
Well, I would also add the just again to hammer this point at the risk of being tedious about it, these groups of people, they come with their own organization. The idea, I mean, the whole thing about unions from the perspective of those hiring them, thinking that this is going to be some sort of short to medium term benefit is just ridiculous. In India, the great classic of statecraft is the Arthashastra by Kautilya, you know, Chandragupta. And there's a great story about how the great king who hired Kautilya as an advisor came across him. He was heading down the road and he saw this weird Brahmin who was pouring a kind of sugar syrup or honey or something at the base of this thistle plant. And, And the prince or whatever stops and looks over, has his retinue stop and asks this guy what the hell he's doing. And this the man who later became the author of the classic of Indian statecraft said, you know, this plant stung me and I've decided to have done with it. And the prince is like, well, how does pouring sugar on it help? He's like, well, sugar gets carried up into the vesicles of the plant and gets distributed throughout it, making it sweet. And the ants will come and they will eat every piece of it from the top to the bottom and eradicate it entirely from existence. There, to say that the Indians or any of these other groups, I mean, the Chinese come, you know, equipped with the Tao and the art of war. You know, they're not unsophisticated peoples. They're not uncivilized peoples. They just have different ways and they come with their own organization. So the idea that, you know, that it's going to be a win somehow to, because they won't unionize, they come with their uncle networks. They come with all their existing arrangements, and they're just not going to do it bluntly in the way that we're accustomed to. They're not going to stand up, and they're not going to have a visible victory. For them, a visible victory is inconsequential. What's sufficient is to win, to have the money flowing, to empty out the organism. You know, like all the shit with the parasitic wasps and the rest. You know, take it over and keep it running. So again, I realize this is this point has already been made, but we have to remember that. And one would hope that that people like Musk would understand it. I mean, any number of people could engage in some research about how these organizations operate, how they conspire, how they work behind the scenes. You know, there are all kinds of conspiracy law. And it's absolutely outrageously powerful stuff. Conspiracy law is what they really come after you with if they want to, you know, rip you up root and branch and destroy you. And what we see with these organizations isn't unions. And, you know, talking about corrupt unions and the rest and Hoffa or people like this, organized crime, and you know, it's absurd compared to the kind of networks that these people bring.
When you talk
anyway, that's an opportunity. Sorry.
When you talk about these people bring their own ways of life, I just want to touch on a few points because I agree with you. And I think I think all of this wealth seeking profiteering is extremely short sighted. And I think the people that practice it don't even realize just how short sighted it is. The first example I'm going to use is Chinatown. If anybody has ever been in any kind of dealings with any kind of Chinatown, you'll know that it has its own ways of doing things. It is only tacitly part of whatever larger area it is, you know, whether it be New York City, Philadelphia, anything like that. It has its own rules. It has its own way of doing things. And everything else is only a tacit attachment. And I can tell you again, as somebody who's been in law enforcement and knows if any of you have friends or family in there, they'll tell you the same thing. Things happen the way Chinatown wants them to happen. That's like the old line in the film. It's Chinatown, Jack. And that's yes, it's Hollywood, but it's based on a reality. That fact is real. And if you don't think that that's real, then I'll move to another example. Look at African-American neighborhoods. Look at Black neighborhoods. They do things the way they want to do them. Maybe you don't want to do them that way. And I'm not even saying that we should want to do things their way, but they do things their way. If they want potholes in the road, they have potholes in the road. If they want buildings to burn down, they burn down. I am from the American Northeast, and I grew up in a city that was voted America's worst city not once but twice. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, there are large sections of this country that are simply ungovernable. Sure, they are ostensibly part of the United States, but not in any real way. Police departments don't go there. Fire departments don't go there. And I believe I talked about this on a previous podcast, but it is directly related to what I'm trying to point out here. The reason that Jeffrey Dahmer got away with as many murders as he did is not because he was brilliant. It's not because he was sneaky. It's because the area in which he lived was ungovernable. He was a white man in a Black neighborhood, and the law was not interested in going there because the people there didn't want it. And all this is to go back to your point, Sebiagog, in that these people have their own way of doing things. And they bring that way with them. And one of the reasons America is fracturing at an exponential rate is because we are getting floods of these people from all around the world, and also specifically South America, Central America. Again, I talked about this recently on a broadcast. I have a friend, and obviously I can't reveal his name, but he is an attorney in the state of Texas. He was the only person that spoke English in that courtroom. They had to get a translator for him. So again, we are talking about these people have their own way of doing things. And I'll close with this. I'll go back to another point that you gentlemen were discussing. The Indians, the caste system, San Francisco and all of them were having a huge problem with racism. And it wasn't white against Indians. It was Indians against other Indians because they were prejudiced against one another. They were attacking one another for their differences. Because as one of you gentlemen pointed out, the tremendous differences in what is only barely and only tacitly a country is actually myriad languages, myriad peoples, et cetera, et cetera. So that's all just to say, if you don't think this is happening, look again, because it has been happening. The only people that assimilated, and I said I would get off my soapbox, I will in a moment, forgive me. But I posit the only people that have assimilated in America are people that are white Western Europeans, because those differences were, I won't say completely, but they were largely ornamental. The Irish were Catholic, the Italians were Catholic. A lot of these people, the English were Christians. We had a lot of undercurrents underneath of us that we shared that we could build off of. Now, I'm not trying to get into any kind of greater debate beyond that. I'm merely trying to say these Europeans were able to assimilate because they already had a shared foundation. And most of the differences were, we could get into the weeds with this, but I prefer not to. But the differences were largely ornamental. Everybody else, not so much. I'll cede the floor, gentlemen.
Well, I want to reinforce something Oliver said before you continue, actually, is elite theory has been promulgated around our circles pretty extensively now. And on what Oliver said earlier, on how these people organize, given the choice between, 10 million Aztecs from South America that are coming in and 100,000 Indians, yeah, I'll take the Aztecs, actually, because they're much less threatening than 100,000 highly organized competitors who are going to be inserted directly into the middle class, especially when, one of them is now becoming the FBI director. So Musk and other people try to be like, oh, well, we only want, 15,000 or 80,000 or whatever. It doesn't matter. If you bring in tens of thousands of these people, look at what's happened in England. Look at how these people are now at the highest levels of government. You think it's less dangerous to bring in, only a few tens of thousands of these people? Think again. But Oliver,
you don't want to join the club, Charlemagne, of having an Indian head of state, with the rest of the Anglosphere
and a mayor and, the whatever party that they're leading to now.
Scotland and so forth have shown us the way, right, Woz?
And being in charge of the city of London, no less. I mean, talk about a castle. But all I was going to say, Charlemagne, was just to hammer the point again, and you made it quite nicely. So to second it, the idea is we're predisposed to think of the manifest aspects of inefficiency, but those are they create inefficiencies, like that example before about how the Coke gets spilled on the floor and people just track through it. Well, that's designed, first off, because they would not literally bend down and metaphorically bend down from their station to clean the floor. But that inefficiency is what creates the opportunity to bring more of them in. I guess what I'm trying to say here, to second your point, Charlemagne, is that there is an outward inefficiency, and it's easy to be dismissive about these people. But what I didn't fully get across before when I was saying, talking about the Arthashastra or the Tao and the art of war, is that these are sophisticated cultures, highly intelligent, and they have ways of doing things. So, and those ways can be highly effective, and we're not predisposed to see them. It's like my old friend Tim used to tell me, he's like, oh, I can always spot an American. If you're abroad and you watch an American walk, particularly if you watch an American walking in East Asia, it's like, oh, there's an American. There's just this swaggered ass thing that, that we do because we feel like, you know, we're treading the boards or whatever. They have no need to do that. They don't need to be seen. They don't need to be known. They don't have to have it be revealed that they have had this success. So yeah, they're a highly sophisticated and effective group of people in their own way. And that, I think, is something that we need to understand. And when I was saying that we could perhaps use this as an angle of approach, what I was talking about more was, it's worth pointing this out to people. Like, you know, when someone said, I don't have the figures at hand and I don't know how to dig into, law enforcement statistics and research or, you know, stuff that comes out of the Justice Department relating to what categories convictions, occurred in and when what racial groups were associated with them. But I think there's a strong argument to be made there, which is, you know, it's not just about how they might be inefficient in running your business, which leads to a certain amount of loss of potential income. If we want to accept their economic arguments, it's also about how they're highly effective at defrauding these organizations. You know, we could talk about fraudulent visas inbound, you know, but what happens when they're in the organization? That's not to say all of them do it, you know, not all, but I've seen enough of it. You know, it's like, I'm not going to hire gypsies to bondo up my truck, you know.
I probably need to be heading out myself around now, but it's been fun talking with y'all. And thanks for having me back on, Moz.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for appearing. Yep. It's been a very animated discussion, so thank you for contributing.
Yeah, a lot of fun. I'll see you guys online.
Thank you. I wanted to go back to what you had last talked about, and the view of America as an economic zone or Americans as a team, and just comment on, you kind of hinted at it. I just want to draw it out. One of the things you can say about this is it's a sort of a spiritually impoverished view of the American nation, right? And seeing us as an economic zone or whatever, even as a team, it doesn't contribute to the nation's myths, you know, the stories it tells about itself. And I say this, by the way, as another guy who works in the tech industry, and I'm happy with my work and everything, but, you know, I don't think the tech bros are going to deeply inspire. And I think we have that going for us, which unfortunately in the short term doesn't necessarily feel like a strong advantage, right? But I think in the long term, it's a very powerful advantage. We have more powerful stories to tell. We hook back into this. The Old Glory Club that a couple of us are part of tells these stories regularly on our Substack and so forth. We go back and we look at the things that really make us feel proud to be Americans. And it's not the story that Elon Musk and Vivek are telling. Right.
Don't discount going to Mars.
Yeah. the thing is, Radlib, as you'll know, computer code can be beautiful. And there's a romance about crafting, you know, the perfect algorithm, the perfect elegant procedure, the function that does something. And I think this is actually where Indians so often show themselves up. I've heard this time and time again from people in IT that the code written by Indians is just awful. It's inelegant, messy. It's not built for being expanded or extended in the future. It's all very just bad crap.
Well, it's within the exact paradigm they work in. When they're given tasks, they implement the algorithms only to do exactly what, you know, their ticket X'd to be implemented and nothing else, because they never ever want to be responsible for anything, right? That avoids it if they only implement exactly what you told them. Anyway, I think you're going to continue there.
Right. Well, the point I was going to make is, so there is a way that this stuff could be inspiring, but it could only be inspiring within a certain context, within an ethnic context, frankly, where a group would be saying, we built these beautiful buildings, we did this wonderful art, we wrote this elegant code. That would be part, I mean, it sounds kind of funny saying it like that, but it would be an element of pride within an ethnic context. But to see it in and of itself, well, it doesn't quite work. There's not the rooting. I think it's the same with all sorts of culture, actually. It just, without that ethnic rooting, it's just sort of meaningless. But especially in this situation where it's not really about the beauty of the code or the quality of the work at all. It's simply these people do it for lower wages. That's really what it is. Because everyone knows that Indian tech workers are not going to be better. I don't give a shit how many high IQ Brahmins you bring over. I know, I just know in my bones that they are not going to be as competent as dedicated high IQ white men. I just know it. And I'm sure that everyone who's talking about this knows it as well, even if they would never say it out loud. So really, it's about cost. So really, it's about exploitation, not to sound like a complete lefty.
No, it's a real point. I mean, one of the things that's been really interesting is, and I think this is something the tech bros are going to really regret, is there's a website where you can look up all the different H-1B visas. They have to disclose what the job is, the company, because, again, these in theory, these jobs have to be advertised to Americans. So you're looking at some of these jobs that they've actually issued H-1B visas for. One was for a laborer. That was the job description, just laborer, for like $20,000. You had plumbers being paid less than like $20 an hour, which is just like slave wages for plumbing. You had golf instructors. Yeti. Apparently Americans can't be golf instructors. Battle Beagle, I think, is one of the people doing this right now, but there are a number of other accounts just going through, just devastating, case after case after case after case. The whole idea that, oh, well, we're just talking about geniuses. You're seeing this kind of like bait and switch or Martin Bailey thing that Elon is doing, where he says, well, I just want the top people. I just want the geniuses. Well, we know that's not true. And this isn't a question of opinion. There's nothing to argue about. We can actually see what the jobs are. And if you look at the kinds of jobs that apparently Americans can't do, it's literally everything. We can't even do unskilled labor like moving a wheelbarrow of dirt, presumably, from one place to another. Even that is too much to ask for. It's obviously just corporate welfare, and it has nothing to do with the free market. It has nothing to do with a meritocracy. It's essentially just a subsidy to people who have no stake in the country. And there's no reason for Americans to go along with it. And it's very disingenuous for people like Musk to pretend that this is all just about super geniuses and that it's just a few hundred people when we're talking about tens of thousands.
Yeah, to build on what Colin was saying as well about the beauty of computer code, I mean, you know, in some cases, these were Japanese men, but I'm always held in awe at what people were able to achieve. You know, I'm a big fan of video games. You know, when they were programming the games for the Super Nintendo or the Nintendo and things like that. And if you're familiar with assembler language, you realize the monumental achievements these people were able to do with only the most basic tools available. And there's something deeply offensive about, you know, having these people come in and, I guess to use an apt metaphor, shit up your code. Some of the code I've seen from these people is just absolutely disgusting, and the metaphor fits perfectly. And it's really a shame. I mean, there's this whole realm of cyberspace that most people are completely unaware of that's driving everything we do right now, even on this website and this app. And, you know, this is a large reason why computer programmers are all becoming trash now. I mean, this is something like we complain about a lot. It has a real impact on everyone's lives when you're having all of this garbage produced by these people who are coming in on the H-1B visas. It's not elite human capital. It's code monkeys who don't know their ass from their elbow when they're, you know, implementing computer programs.
To tie a few of these points together, to tie up your point earlier, Colin, Charlamagne, a couple things you said, and things that have also been mentioned throughout the conversation, a lot of it does come down to just the people. There is an ethnic component to all of it. What do you value? And it goes back to Semiagog's point about these people literally or figuratively won't bend over to clean something. I think it's all very fractal in the sense it starts small and then it builds up to larger things. These other countries are crappy because their outlook on the world is crappy. It's a grim place to live because they make it a grim place to live. There is no magic dirt, but there's also very little cursed dirt as well. Sure, we could get into the weeds about Death Valley or things like that, environmental conditions, but I think you understand the larger point I'm making. The world is what you make of it. And to step back to your point, Charlamagne, regarding there's a beauty in certain things and Colin's point about even code has an elegance. You mentioned, Charlamagne, that you were a you're a video game fan. I generally listen to Baroque classical music when I'm working, but I can appreciate a lot of the video game soundtracks. I don't see it as any real difference from opera from the 18th century. That was their form of entertainment. You have your form of entertainment. But if you can listen to the strings and all of it, maybe it's synthesized, but there's still a beauty to some of these soundtracks. The one that I still listen to somewhat regularly was from a game called Frostpunk, and it has a cello and violins, and it's beautiful. So I think there can be beauty in a lot of these things, but I think it all stems from that root or that basic fractal of a certain amount of pride, a certain amount of value, and a certain way of doing things, a certain perspective. And there is an elegance to things, and I think we're blessed to be part of a culture and an ethnicity that can appreciate these things and can turn things that could otherwise be crappy, you know, a messy bunch of numbers, into an elegant and effective tool.
Well, yeah, indeed. And I think that is something that's pretty much unique to, well, it is unique to us and the Japanese, I think. I think we're the only people who get this.
Yeah. Oh, and on that point to the Japanese, Colin, Charlemagne, something else you mentioned about coding. I've been in a dozen bands. I play a few instruments, and I'm not an expert, but I've done my own audio engineering. And I came across the replacement for the MP3 audio codec format called Vorbis. And the point of my story here, I'll get right to it, is there was a Japanese man who just revised it and improved it on his own time, on his own dime, on the side. And he made incredible advancements to it, just on his own. Just, hey, you know what? Hey, I wanted to make this better because that's the kind of person I am. Because it's in his ethnicity to improve things. He exactly. sees something that somebody built, and he said, you know what? I want to make this better. And if anybody's interested in looking for it, it's called Og Vorbis, OGGVORBIS. And his improvements to it are AOTUV. And it's partially named after him. But that's to say that, again, it's, as you said, Colin, it's Europeans of European stock. I consider Americans European stock. And Japanese, basically, are the people in the world that just have this outlook.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't know that specific example, but it tallies with other. I've heard other stories about Japanese engineers doing this kind of thing. There was one guy who wrote. Well, it doesn't matter. It's too specific to go into. It's to do with synthesizers, and no one's into that. But to get back to Elon Musk,
I am. We'll talk offline. Yeah. I'll listen to that story later, Colin.
There was one tweet he made, like I think today or yesterday, where he said, because we're talking about the short-termism of importing H-1B workers. And he said, someone had obviously said, well, why, if there is a shortage of white, American workers, which I don't believe for a second, I think there's a huge surplus, and it's all to do with diversity hiring. That's why white men are not getting these jobs in the first place. But someone said, if there is a shortage of them, why can't we just train our own? And Elon Musk said, if you have to talk about schools like training and the quality of education and so on, then you're already losing. So it would take 20 years for a new generation to be schooled, and you could do whatever, add anything you wanted to the curriculum, but it would take 20 years. So you're already losing. Well, that is extremely, this goes to show the corporate mindset, where you should be thinking about a nation and a people, in which case 20 years is not a long time to invest. But instead, he's talking about the profit margin now. So 20 years is too long to wait. So we've got to import loads of people in order to make up the shortfall now, well, regardless of the long-term effects. Well, this is just crazy. I don't know if anyone.
Well, it's literally the same argument they use for importing low-status labor. It's like, these people will do the jobs Americans want. It's literally the same argument that the left uses, is that there's jobs that need to be done, so we're going to bring in people to do it. And it's all based on this assumption that the native population won't do it. How can that assumption even be made if Elon Musk is such a data nerd, and he's, he knows that DEI, so-called, has suppressed the native talent? Well, the data is not even available then for what the native talent actually is, because it's been suppressed. So how can he even give us numbers regarding how many people we need to import when we don't even know what we're working with by the metrics that he has cited as being suppressed by this program. So even within his own frame of logic, his logic doesn't check out.
There's also a huge amount of nihilism implicit in this outlook. And again, it almost goes back to the idea of everything being a scam, that the idea is just to do a rug pull and then get out of there and leave everybody else to deal with the fallout. If we've gotten to the point where we can't even count on educating the workforce, where even educating a workforce is a waste of time, and you can always just bring in people from the rest of the world, particularly from these countries where they have these universities that are not particularly good. I mean, I don't think a lot of these Indian colleges are necessarily known for their academic rigor. Then why bother doing anything? I mean, this is the one big question that I think is being ignored by everybody in government. There's no reason to talk about education. There's no reason to talk about healthcare. There's no reason to talk about defense. There's no reason to talk about any of these things, because any problem that we have, the premise is always that the people who are already here, that is the real problem. And we can always bring in somebody better from overseas to replace them and sort of fix whatever gap that we have. And we can just keep doing that forever. And if that's the way we're going to conduct business, no one has any reason to invest in this country for the long term, certainly to care or sacrifice for this country long term, to have any feeling for the country in the long term. But I think that with somebody like Elon Musk and with a lot of the people who are coming in and know in their hearts what their real ethnic homeland is. I mean, specifically with these Indian Americans, so-called Indian Americans, who have said the most outrageous things about our people and our country in the last few days. I don't think there's even the pretense anymore that this is good for the country. I think that just as with any immigration debate, it usually goes from this is good for the country to this is actually revenge and you deserve this as punishment. We're seeing that even with the H-1B visa debate. And I think what has to happen, I don't know if it's going to happen. I think maybe Musk has too much influence or money or whatever else. But we haven't yet seen a single politician come out and say, look, we know what this is really about. We know that you don't even share the same end as us. We know that you don't actually want the best for this country. You're just here to pull a scam and then get out. I don't think that even the pretense of a debate or something that where we have some sort of common interest can be maintained much longer. The longer this goes on, the more emotional everybody on all sides are getting. And I think the collective racial interests and the really mercenary short-term economic attitudes are coming to the fore. And a lot of the propaganda, like the idea that we're recruiting the best and the brightest, all that's falling away in record time. I don't think anybody believes that anymore. I don't even think the people who are making the argument are going to be doing the pretense of it much longer.
No, the whole thing where the frogs have gone through the H-1B public database has totally owned Musk and Ramaswamy.
Yeah, it's annihilated everything.
Which is, of course, what the frogs do. And that's what Elon Musk is experiencing right now is, okay, well, you're letting us loose for the most part. You're allowing us to say what we want on this platform. We're going to dig into things like that, find it, expose the lies almost instantly, and, you know, praise be to the people who did all that work. And look, you got owned, and you're going to have to accept those consequences if you're legitimately for, you know, so-called free speech and democracy or whatever. And
sorry to interrupt. Could you outline what the frogs found in the H-1B database? What was it that destroyed Elon Musk's argument?
Well, basically, Musk is talking about importing, you know, only the most elite human capital through this program, the highest engineers. And you look at the actual database, all of the jobs that are H-1B are publicly listed. And there's literally jobs in there like janitor and truck driver and things like this, pickleball instructor, literally. And it's like, well, this is what the program is being used for. We know that it's never used for these elite people that are, you know, the top 0.1% of the world that's going to come in. Every administration before the one coming in has told us the same lie, that it's going to bring in the best of the best. Why should we believe you now? We've exposed this program for exactly what it is, And so you just have to own it now. And this is the consequence of, you know, setting the frogs loose on Twitter. If you're really for free speech and democracy, so-called, this is the consequences of that. And you could either deal with it or you can betray us like everyone else has before you, which wouldn't be a surprise. But that's what's been revealed, is the completely fraudulent nature of this program. It absolutely does not bring in the best talent of the world. It right. simply brings in people to take more jobs from middle-class Americans.
Well, I saw also, one thing that was an article by some researcher who I think herself was actually Indian. She had a, you know, sort of Indian sounding name. And she said that her conclusion was that 94% of H-1B workers, I believe that's correct, don't have the skills that they claim to have. It's fraud. I mean,
No, they're professional liars.
Yeah.
It goes back to Gregory's point about the validity of a lot of these of their documents. Goes back to Gregory's point about the validity of their education systems. You'll find a lot of them, if they're not outright fallacious and non-existent, you'll find they're subpar at best to Western standards. So even if you do get them with an air quote degree, it really won't be worth the paper it's printed on, 99 times out of 100. The other point I'd like to mention too is I certainly believe the frogs are finding these things, and I am grateful to them for doing it. But I would also like to point out that understand many of these jobs don't even really exist. That's just the pretense to get somebody here so they don't have to wait in line like everybody else to move to this country. They just come up with, yeah, I need a pickleball instructor, sure. So that way my wife's uncle's brother can come in, or my wife's, my sister's aunt's, you know, husband, whatever. Again, you guys are correct. I'm not arguing with you that it isn't used for profiteering. It is. But I'm telling you, there's so many other facets of it too, because that's why every liquor store, help me out here, gas station, liquor store,
Hotels, motels,
Dunkin' Donuts, why they're all Indian, because it's chain migration fraud. What it is first guy comes in, he gets the property, he invests in the business, and then he runs it for a couple years tax-free because he's a foreigner running it. Then he sells it to his cousin who does the same thing for 2 years, and they put everybody else out of business because they can hire their family for next to $0, work them like slaves. I see Rad nodding his head. He knows exactly what I'm talking about, right?
The Patel Motel Cartel.
Yes, that's exact. And it's again, oh, Americans are lazy. They don't want to start a business. They don't want to work. It's like, no, they simply can't. And again, I spoke at a recent podcast where I was talking about growing up, where I grew up in New Jersey. There was a guy, and I mean, looking back on it now, I'm older, but so he probably was only in his mid-30s at the time, but I was 19 or 20, so he seemed so much older and mature than me. He ran the gas station. I used to pull my Mustang up, and I'd fuel up, and he and I would talk, and he'd say, I'm going to be out of business in 2 years. And I'd look at him, and I'd go, so how are you going to be out of business? You're on a major highway. You're on one of the biggest highways in the state. And he'd say, because I can't compete with him. And he'd point, because they're all Indians and they all don't pay taxes and they all don't have to pay their employees. And I do. And sure enough, 2 years later, he was gone. And ever since then, 19, I will not. And you can say it's racist all you like. I will not go to those people's businesses. If I walk into a Subway, a coffee shop, a hotel, I immediately turn around and walk out. It has nothing to do with hate. It has everything to do with these people have stolen all of the options, or many of the options of my own countrymen.
So you're saying even with the with back to the H-1B thing, you're saying we don't even get the damn pickleball instructors.
Come on. Yes, I'm saying we don't even get the pickleball instructor.
And you have to look at it as part of the larger picture, as I guess is central to your point, which is that this cannot be considered in isolation. It is another part of this tapestry of dispossession, if I'm allowed to get a bit poetic about it. And I mean, it comes down to the same way. Like I saw that there was a whole bunch of stuff going around about, I believe with this last Biden administration, about all sorts of largesse was going to be distributed through the farm administration, you know, and this was going to be, it was this whole thing about racism in rural areas and how federal money had to be made available to deal with racism in rural areas, which basically means you get the whole gravy train client relationship going in these rural areas so that you can get in touch with the, you know, let's just say in this case of North Georgia, whomever was selected in the black population there as someone who was a leader, right? And the largesse flows out through these groups. The same kind of thing is happening with Indians. You know, when you bring in ones who run motel chains, you know, these are they become powerful franchisees.
Yes.
You know, who affect the overall corporate direction and then are therefore susceptible to the gibs that come down through the pipeline for that client group. And then as part of this larger picture that we have to remember forms the backdrop for what Musk is talking about, you may well find that there's a whole lot of these the special visas that have to be distributed, let's say this year in Twin Falls, Idaho, or whatever region it is that has to be, they like to call it integration. I prefer to think of it as what it is, which is disintegrated. These regions need to be disintegrated to move it forward, you know, for the voting patterns to change and the entire structure of incentive to change.
Well, I agree. I wholeheartedly agree. And I would say, and I'm going to watch my words very, very carefully here because our host is not in America. So I will watch what I say very, very carefully here. I will say that the decline that we as Americans have been experiencing for some time and the betrayals that we have suffered at the hands of our, and I use this word very loosely, leaders, our patience is running thin. And I think even though we may have very few options, these people are running out of options as we run out of patience. And again, I'm trying to watch what I say very, very carefully here. So I think that even what I'm trying to say is this, and I'll keep it cryptic. Even our black pill is a white pill if you're willing to roll your sleeves up and get the jobs done. So as time progresses, I think even the black pill could become a white pill. And I'll leave it at that.
Earlier, I look forward to a major Devin Stack transformation. Sorry.
Earlier, I exclaimed how you know, these people are professional liars, and this kind of goes into the scam aspect of this. So, you know, these people like Musk talk about bringing in the best of the best, but that's often a lie too. I told a story earlier about encountering these people professionally back when I was in university. There were multiple groups of Indians, and what they would do is they would cooperate together in their little ethnic groups, and they would literally cheat on tests during exams very openly. And, you know, as it turns out, it's simply too much work for the professors to really be bothered with academic discipline in these cases, you know, which would result in expulsion. And they just sort of let them get through the courses so long as it's not hugely troublesome. So, you know, these people end up basically cooperating on a degree together and they receive their credentials, but the credentials are a lie. So Musk talks about, you know, the top 0.1% or whatever, but, you know, the fact that these people are cheaters simply disappears into the ether. They get their degree and then all the evidence that the degree is fake is just gone because it was all just, you know, other classmates observing them and no action was ever taken. So there's not even a reliable way to ensure that, you know, their credentials as the top 0.1% are even real.
Yeah. To speak to your point very directly, Charlemagne, when I was working for immigration, part of my job later on, when I gave up my gun and badge and I just wrote a desk, I did marriage fraud investigation. And what we would do there is we would have to contact these people that were marrying U.S. citizens. We'd have to contact their embassies in their home countries, their home communities. We'd have to make sure these people weren't already married. So that you know, because obviously a previous marriage that had not been annulled or ended would stop this marriage from being valid. And I could tell you firsthand from experience that many of these countries in South America and Asia, specifically India, was one I would run into frequently. You'd wait for anywhere from 3 to 6 months just to get a reply. And I can't even speak to the accuracy of the reply. Like maybe what they'd send you would be illegible. It would be waterlogged. It would be just a complete mess. You'd wait 3 to 6 months for a reply. So again, you have no idea what's coming at you from all these places. You have no idea. Nobody's vetted, and there's no way to even vet them. There's no medical records. There's no vaccination records. None of this in too many areas to even list. So I just wanted to attach that to your point. That's all.
And all social organization is based, I'm going to get on my damn hobby horse now, because I'm big into the idea that there is a form of writing that precedes what we think of as writing proper, and that it's biological. It's basically territorial marks, environmental marks, and hierarchical marks. And this whole false distinction about like oral and literate cultures gets rather tiresome. But here the point is that that's how we organize ourselves. And we have two institutions that give us our world today, the liberal institution of individual rights and habeas corpus and all the rest, civil society only exists at the sufferance of having a secondary social organization that's older, more primitive, more basic, and more fit for crisis, which is the military. And that's why we have the idea of civil law versus martial law. And if there's real trouble, we revert just like the Romans would, where they would hire a dictator for a period, right? And in the military, it's very clear. You have like, stolen valor. You have the idea of perfidy, false flags. You have the idea of rank and the insignia that you wear for that rank that makes everything work. If you have like these 10 people in a room and they're all in green uniforms and their insignia has been stripped off, the entire animal falls to pieces. If you have people who are moving boundary stones, then everything about how the farmland is laid out gets called into question, and you have strife, you have economic difficulty, your courts are clogged up with cases. Like everything falls apart if you do not have a point of orientation. So with all societies, you can say, like the example I always like to use is like with a mosque, you've got a minaret. And in the old days before sound systems, the range that a muezzin could get up at the top of the mosque and do the call to prayer, that was the range of the community for the mosque. In Europe, you had a clock tower with bells, right, that would ring the different periods of prayer during the day. And that's also how your social organization happened, because when you were in church, you weren't at the market, right? And people would say, well, at third bell or whatever, we'll meet and do such and such. With the ancient Egyptians, they had the gnomon in the center, this single, like the obelisk, right, which allows you to mark the passage of time against the sky, but it also casts a shadow on the ground. That has to do with just like a sundial, right? It's your clock. It allows your social organization. You know where it is. It stands against the horizon. It's a landmark. So whether we're talking about landmarks and the way that they use to mark the passage of time with the shadow or the stars against the sky, you need a fixed position. You need something you can rely upon, like a territorial mark, like rank, insignia. But with these credentials being all crap, with the idea that we don't know whether or not the meal ticket that got stamped really is a meal ticket. If your PhD, your post-hole digger, that you've so proudly obtained for yourself, if it's genuine, if we don't know whether or not the physician who's taking care of you actually is qualified to do this, everything falls apart. And what we have imported and what we have encouraged fundamentally is the disappearance of all the points of social orientation that allow for behavioral integration. So what we're really looking at here, whether we're talking about Musk's H-1B visas or immigration fraud or all these different areas in which credentials are ridiculous. I mean, and it could just be DEI shit, right? It doesn't even have to be someone from outside the country. We can't rely. I mean, black pilots, I get freaked out about having to go to a physician who's younger than I am. And that gets to be more and more trouble as I get older. And I'm like, I don't trust you, cocksucker. Who the fuck are you? You haven't been around long enough. You're not going to cut me open.
Relatable.
But that's what we're facing. I think behind all of this is a fundamental breakdown in everything, because there is no fixed position. And once the distribution of territory, once the organization in social hierarchy and rank, not to mention all the various professional qualifications, once they're called into question, I mean, the Potemkin village is on fire.
Yeah, I mean, it's social disintegration, isn't it? Because all of these standards are the things that people take for granted in everyday life. Like when you go to the doctor, you assume that he is qualified and all that. I mean, it's such a basic thing. I can't believe I even need to say it, you know? But you assume
yeah, but you're that laughing. The you laugh now.
Is, yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't want to cut you up, but you laugh now. But like,
I know. I'm laughing while I still can.
It's the laughter of the damned. It's the Taoist laughter of the damned. That's really what it is. At least that's how I interpret it. This is like, yeah, he gets it. I mean, like, it's like, what are you going to do?
Well, you know, but you're, I mean, it's, I'd be crying. Like a friend worked in an optometrist.
Well, that's what Zen laughter is. It's tears, but in a different form. Yeah, exactly. Yes, yeah.
But I'm sorry, ophthalmologist's office, and they were going to do surgery on this person's eye because they had one bad one and one good one. They operated on the damn wrong eye, you know? I mean, this kind of stuff happens more and more and more.
See, this is like the horror story where you hear about someone who went in, they needed their leg amputated, and they amputated the wrong one. So now they've got no legs. You know, this kind of awful, awful worst case scenario, but which could so easily happen, especially with a bloody language barrier.
Well, what they don't like to remind us of, what's the third leading cause of death in the United States? Anybody know?
Medical malpractice, right?
Yep, you got it. Greg's got it. That's exactly it. Medical malpractice.
And even that, I mean, to carry forward, I'm foaming at the mouth now, but to go forward with the idea that you cannot rely upon any of the indicators. The statistics are screwed. I mean, we've all seen the pictures of the so-called white perpetrators that have to do with the racial breakdown of, you know, crimes committed and victims and all the rest. Yeah. Like every aspect of this, I mean, or just the printing money and arguing about whether or not the gross domestic product is X or, you know, or whether it's purchasing power parity. Everything that we use to orient at a distance has been vitiated and subverted. And we are increasingly operating at a distance through these mediated platforms. So some people get to see real statistics, presumably. Mm-hmm. So it's at least possible that somewhere up there they know how screwed we are. But do we? And it comes down to that whole business of when you go to talk to the doctor. You know, if I'm going to go talk to Ramaswamy about my rash, you know, does he have a degree? I mean, we just heard that the guy who drove over all those people in the Christmas market was a Saudi immigrant who was working as a psychiatrist or a psychologist, a psychiatrist, I believe. I mean, they said he was a medical doctor, and he's issuing prescriptions and shit, right?
Well,
and
so less harmful than the typical immigrant doctor at the British NHS, but.
Yeah, I don't even want to.
You've seen how many of the medical malpractice out of those guys? I mean, it's out of control in terms of the people that they're bringing in to do these jobs. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I just wanted to make the quick point that when I was working for Vita back when, one of the things that Peter was always seizing on, because you would see it again and again and again, is whenever you had the Medicare fraud, or for that matter, whenever you had a Medicare fraud tied to the PPP program, it was almost always Pakistanis, Indians. I mean, that same subcontinental thing over and over and over again. And these are just the cases that we know about. These are just the cases that get prosecuted. And certainly, I don't think I have to tell any of you gentlemen how many cases of PPP fraud went completely unchecked. I mean, we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars just down the drain.
Oh, absolutely.
But this is the kind of thing that I think is going to be inevitable. We're going to see a slowdown of, well, gradual growing dysfunction, where things that could be taken for granted, just ordinary bureaucratic procedures of one kind or another, can no longer be taken for granted, either because they're just forgotten about, not they don't happen, or they're done badly, leading to erroneous outcomes. So I think, you know, when you've got people who aren't enamored by excellence, who aren't excited by the idea of, you know, the good, the true, and the beautiful. When they're not motivated to do that, when they're only motivated to get by, to pass the test, to, you know, whatever, then this is going to be the result. And of course, then that sort of illustrates why the West is the way it is and why Japan is the way it is, and the rest of the world isn't that way, because they don't have these drives that we keep coming back to.
It can be hard to understand, to put yourself in someone else's mind as a Westerner, that, you know, this person doesn't care if this job is a good fit for them, if they have the skills that are really needed for the job and that they can do well at the job. They literally are going to just say whatever you want to hear to get into the job. You know, it's like, it's a little hard to wrap your head around it, coming from sort of a Western ideals of excellence and stuff, right? And so you will grant people too much charity, I guess is what I'm saying. You know, you'll assume for them, oh, well, they probably, you know,
They were trying their best.
Yeah, you attribute to them motives that you would have in that position that maybe they don't have in some cases. Right?
Positive projection. You're assuming.
Yeah, positive projection. Thank you. Great term. Thank you.
And Colin, just to agree and amplify your point just very, very briefly. I mean, there are planes literally falling out of the sky now. I mean, that's not even a metaphor. Wasn't it Boeing just had half a dozen that they actually let get on the news? So to go back to sort of Gregory's point, that's just what we know about. I mean, how many are really happening? Planes are literally falling out of the skies. And it's only going to go down from here, gentlemen. It's only going to go down from here.
And the statistics prevent any kind of forensic examination, any kind of monitoring of what's going on, because they've been vitiated, as mentioned. And then where you don't have flat out fraudulent qualifications or, you know, certifications or what have you, they've simply been dropped. They've been lowered. Like, I mean, I seriously would worry about police coming to my house and having some ovulating cop, you know, empty her magazine into me because something was unexpected and frightened her. Or, I mean, I'm supposed to be carried out of a burning building by a can-do lesbian, you know, who's 50% of my weight. I mean, or soldiers that can't be carried out of, you know, out of a combat zone to receive medical treatment because the girls can be Army Rangers now or whatever it is. I mean, that's just,
I know it's farcical, and I'm sorry, but I had the mental image there of Semi Agog being carried out of a burning building by two skinny lesbians. That's hilarious.
Well, no, they wouldn't be skinny. They would.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think skinny's the last thing they'd be.
And you're complaining, Semi Agog. You don't like it. But yeah, obviously I jest, but it's a funny mental image. But the reality is dire. I mean, it's a very bad situation. And as Charles said, yeah, we already see this. There are multiple things in the last couple of years where it's, you know, some engineering project has messed up, and it's because of the diversity. I mean, there was the bridge that was designed. Yes. I can't remember whether that got debunked in the end, but the bridge, and it was apparently designed by a female engineering team, and then it collapsed.
Oh, in Florida? No, I don't think it was ever debunked. I think that ended up being 100% true. That was an all female construction site. And maybe somebody will point out in the comments that I'm incorrect, but I don't ever remember seeing anybody debunking it. If you're referring to the one that was a couple of years ago in Florida that collapsed.
Yeah, that one.
Mm-hmm. Or air traffic controllers. You know, that's another exciting one to think about. Or even people who just manage ship traffic or deal with, like, pilot certifications. Didn't Boston just lose an entire enormous bridge because some ship piloted, by Indians, if I remember correctly?
That was in Baltimore, wasn't it?
It was Baltimore, not Baltimore. But yeah, you're right. Yeah, your point stands. Yeah.
And you guys bring up all the grand planes and bridges and stuff. I'm just thinking about, you know, dealing with anyone in a service job, and they're just they look at me like I'm inconveniencing them as the customer, right? This is a daily part of our life now.
Yeah. I think that the only thing I've disagreed with anybody on this whole panel has said, and even then it's only because of my personal experiences, when Charlemagne said he'd rather have the 100,000 Aztecs than the 10,000 Indians. I'm like, no, I know the Aztecs are only a couple hundred years away from sacrificing people on the altar, and I've dealt with more than enough of them to know they'll cut my heart out too when I deal with them. But other than that, no, I mean, I still see his point though overall. I do the larger and more subtle and insidious effects of the 10,000. But yeah, I think if I had to choose, I still don't want 100,000 screaming bloodthirsty maniacs in my neighborhood, because I've already had them kill somebody on my front lawn, literally. But that's a story I don't care to go into right now.
So I guess what we're saying here is Merry Christmas.
Yeah. and as a point of levity, I get the feeling that if Semyagog and I had a couple whiskeys between us, we end up in balaclavas and getting into a whole lot of trouble by
No. I am a law abiding person.
Oh, excuse me. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, you're right. Pardon me.
Well, yeah, the point I was wanting to make is just to underline that the H-1B thing relates to a broader issue, which is as white societies what we used to call white societies are increasingly populated and worked by non-whites, especially from certain parts of the world, the function that we used to take for granted in everyday life is going to fade away. Obviously, it's what we've been talking about for years, and the H-1B thing just brings it back to the fore, because it's so mercenary for these tech billionaires to be talking about this when everyone knows, as I said, that it's got nothing to do with capability. It's simply that these people are cheaper. Can we get back to that and think about the longer term implications? Because one possible scenario here is that the alliance that seems to have been forming between Trump and Elon Musk could be seriously ruptured by this. Gregory?
Yeah, I think that's a serious consideration. I mean, one of the things that I think Musk and maybe some of his allies haven't taken into consideration is the left really turned on big tech in a way that we haven't seen before over the last couple of years. And then we saw some proposals over the last campaign, not just for social media censorship, but also that they're going to do a tax on unrealized gains, which would just instantly destroy the economy. Huge increases in the rates of taxation on the wealthy, a lot more regulations in terms of DEI standards when it comes to even big tech industry, because if you look at one of the big pushes by the Biden administration, they wanted to have semiconductor manufacturing brought to the United States. So Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing tried to relocate a number of its plants to the United States, and they were going to start building them here, but they couldn't do it. And the reason they couldn't do it is because they put in all these DEI standards, and it turns out you can't find enough black women to like make semiconductors, and the whole thing fell apart. Guys like Musk and a lot of other people clearly saw the writing on the wall and clearly understood that this was an existential threat, that they were really coming for them this time. And I think that's why they tactically shifted to Trump, not because they really changed their mind about anything. But now they feel like they're in the position to sort of dictate terms to Trump and his coalition. And I don't think they understand that, you know, you guys are locked in here with us now. Like, there's no going back for somebody like Elon Musk. They're not going to take him back. And the type of people who are going to take over the Democratic Party are people like AOC. I think you're going to see a real surge in outright socialism in the coming years. I mean, look at the support for among normies for the healthcare executive who was basically killed in the street. And if you go on TikTok now, the alleged assassin, is basically a folk hero. I mean, that's what's out there right now. And I think that's only going to intensify with Trump in office, and the left kind of has the devil figure that they want. And I think Musk is really, he doesn't see what time it is. And I think he's really overestimating how much popularity he personally has. You can only really fight one front at a time in both military and political war. And Musk has chosen this moment to basically go to war with the left and the right simultaneously. And to try to compete with Donald Trump, who, whatever else we may say about him, we know is a pretty jealous guy when it comes to cultivating the love of the public. I would not be surprised if Musk becomes just the latest of Trump's best friends who gets tossed out once he's perceived as a threat. And as far as J.D. Vance goes, it's anybody's guess, because though Vance has done some good things and said some good things, as a matter of fact, as we were sitting here talking, he actually retweeted something saying, you know, America is a people, not just a place. That was a direct attack on the things that Vivek was saying. But, I mean, and I'm trying not to be indelicate here. I, of all people, trying not to be indelicate. I mean, he's married to an Indian. His whole family is Indian. What, he's going to go out there and say Indian immigration is a threat to the United States? I mean, Vance is going to have a tough rope to cross with this, too. I think the danger to the MAGA coalition is severe, but I also think that this fight was inevitable, and I think so far it's gone about as good as it could have gone. It's just that I think Musk is – I mean, I'm distracted right now because I'm kind of watching this happen on X. I mean, I encourage you guys to take a look at this when we all get off here. I mean, he's going completely insane right now, banning people left and right. I mean, this could be the end of the X that we've come to know and love.
Yeah, there are various people who, as Laura Loomer actually got
the Groypers just got completely nuked. I mean, Fuentes himself is still on there, but all of his people have basically gotten taken out. Musk, well, the guy who everybody thinks is Musk on, I forget what the name is, but the one who everybody thinks is like his
Adrian.
Old ego, apparently arguing with Keith Woods on some spaces, and they were going back and forth, and all these other people are going back and forth. And it's not. The problem is once you've set that precedent, it's not about like, oh, what do you think of this guy or that guy? Once you've set the precedent of, well, I can ban these people in particular, he's just going to keep doing it. I mean, what we all kind of hoped is that there would be a systemic solution to the problem of free speech when it comes to mainstream social media platforms. I mean, obviously, platform access is a civil right, which is something that even some center-right conservatives were talking about a few years ago. That would have been the big fix. We didn't see anything about it during Trump's first term. And unfortunately, that's one of the things that I actually am black-pilled on. With Musk in charge, Trump has no reason to push for such a policy because he thinks that Musk is on his side and that he thinks he probably can control Musk. And so the problem is we're all basically at the whims of whatever big tech guy happens to own which platform. And the sad part is X is probably the best thing we've got going other than Rumble. I mean, I don't think I have to tell any of you gentlemen that how precarious it is on YouTube or any of the other ones out there. And TikTok, I mean, who knows if TikTok will even exist in a few weeks.
Well, one thing we can say regarding J.D. Vance's family is that no one hates Indian men more than Indian women. So there might be that going for him.
Watch her turn out to be like she's the big immigration hawk in the new administration. She's just like, oh, get these people out of here. It's terrible. No more.
One thing we can see literally as we speak is Musk sort of trying to find his out here, and this is actually really important to the people who have taken the right track on this whole thing is to treat this problem as if, you know, it is Musk's platform and he's in charge here. And we his loyal retinue are advising him on his error, right? You really don't want to go out of your way to insult this guy or inflame the tensions any more than is needed. And we're seeing now he's sort of looking for the graceful exit to the situation he's found himself in. Like, he just did one of his infamous replies where he just like does a one word reply to someone. You know, he replied true to this account that says that, you know, white men are being discriminated against by woke HR and hiring managers. And to me, that's signaling that, you know, he's not just going to come out and admit that he got owned and was wrong, but he needs some sort of out here. And given that he is an ally in this coalition, and he is in charge of this platform, we need to do everything possible to give him as many opportunities as are available without compromising our position to re-enter the fold as part of Trump's coalition, while understanding that he doesn't have the right to dictate terms here just because of his assistance in the campaign.
Yeah, gentlemen, I need to get going too, but I want to close with this one thing. You know, some of my friends are really into jiu-jitsu and stuff, and there's a saying one of them has, sometimes you'll be seeing two guys rolling and one will be kind of trapped underneath, and he's not in a hold. He can't really tap out, but he's being crushed. He can't breathe. He's clearly not having a good time. There's nothing he can really do, and he doesn't want to be there anymore. And my one friend has a saying, you know, he's looking for a way out. He's looking for a way out. He wants to tap. He wants to get out of this. He wants to have enough of an excuse to surrender with dignity and be done with this. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that's what Musk is trying to do right now. And maybe the best thing to do is have enough good grace to give him an out and almost reassure him that we still basically consider him on side. He's just wrong on this one thing. And hopefully he's learned a lesson. So with that, I want to thank you, everyone, for letting me join. I really appreciate it.
Greg, just before you, thank you for taking part. But just before you go, there was a super chat earlier that was directed at you. So I'll ask it now. Yeah. This is from Green Party. What does Greg think about outlets such as IM1776, Revolver News, Passage Press, etc., that seem to be doing excellent work, but have a disproportionate amount of a certain group involved? Are they allies?
Well, this is one of the big things, and obviously bringing up what just happened with the purge of a lot of the gruppers on X just now, obviously there's a big fight because they'll say, well, a lot of these publications are subversive, and this is all part of the Vance network, the BAP network, the Teal network, or all these types of things. Now, I'm going to say this because, you know, normally I wouldn't broach this, but, I mean, this was revealed in my docs years ago. As the whole world knows, if anybody wanted to, I met with Teal years and years ago during the first campaign. I'll add that I never got a dime from them, and I don't even think I know anybody who's allowed to use PayPal. So it hasn't done me any good. And everybody I know also got banned from Facebook and everything else. So if there is a network, I'm not part of it. It's a big club and I'm not in it. But I'm not sure that a lot of these things have been as centrally. Maybe I'm just naive and there may be some people who think that. But I don't think these things are as centrally controlled or being as cynically directed as a lot of people think, because I know a lot of people who are involved in these different things, and a lot of them have very different opinions. And some of these people I've known going back like 15, 20 years. And this is not, I don't think that they have this program in place where they're sucking up this populist energy and then redirecting it into dead ends simply so the incoming Trump administration is fanatically Zionist and pro-cheap labor or whatever the other big things that people are concerned about. I think there are real concerns going in, but the one thing that I've been a little frustrated about is I don't think there's a lot you can say about Trump 2024 that you couldn't also say about Trump 2016. Like, there is a case to be made. There is a very strong case in my mind to be made that what Trump is doing is white people who maybe were getting frustrated with the system and looking for a radical alternative, he is letting them think that they have a stake in the system and that he is kind of rounding off the harsh edges and all this energy is going to be redirected into safe paths. And really, this is the same sort of thing that even like a George W. Bush did. I don't buy that, but I think there is a case for it. But what I reject is if you believe that, and if you really believe that we shouldn't be aligned with any of this stuff and these people are enemies and we need to have a totally radical alternative, there's nothing different about now than there was in 2016. I mean, was there ever a time when Donald Trump was not pro-Israel? Was there ever a time when Donald Trump was not even talking about bringing in more legal immigration? He said a lot of these same sorts of things in 2016. He opposed H-1Bs, but at the same time, he would also say, oh, we're going to bring in good workers legally and everything else. If you're looking for something to be upset about, you're going to find it. And I don't trust Trump. I was totally done with him in 2020. I wanted to make him White Renegade of the Year, which was basically like White Traitor of the Year, because I thought he had just blown it so badly in that final year. But what I, and maybe I'm too cynical about this, but I think that people who think that there is an alternative may imagine that there are more of us than there really are. I don't think that if we just drop out of all this, oppose these groups, declare people enemies because they're not with 100% of the things that we want, that therefore the country will fall into our lap tomorrow. A certain publication or a certain guy on Twitter or another person in the dissident right is not the thing that's holding back one radical faction from taking over the country tomorrow. It just doesn't work that way. And now we're already talking about Donald Trump and how we're going to break up the MAGA coalition and we're going to do this and do that. But let's face it, guys, I don't think that victory that he won in 2024, I mean, yeah, he won the popular vote, but it was not some overwhelming, crushing victory. The demographics are such that the Republican will never win a Reagan second-term victory ever again. And there is a time limit here. The numbers are getting so much worse that it's going to be impossible for anybody right of center to ever win at a certain point. Like, if something is going to happen, it really does have to happen in the next couple of years. And so my position has always been, and will always continue to be, and presumably as long as I'm with Amran, it will continue to be, is I'm pretty much going to work with anyone who will work with me. And there are some people who won't work with me because I try to be friends with everyone. And ironically, if you try to be friends with everyone, you end up making enemies inadvertently. But I think that there's too few of us for us to be picking internal fights right now. And as far as I'm concerned, the immigration issue is the only thing that we can really afford to spend all our energy on right now. And I'm willing to forgive quite a lot on just about everything else if we can take a hard line on immigration. Of course, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, because this was inevitable, the H-1B immigration issue is part of that. And if that means that we have to confront Musk, so be it. But as we've discussed, I think we can do it in a way that's respectful. As far as like the specifics, those particular publications, I would add that I don't know any of these guys personally too well. I mean, I'm sure I've met some of them, but most of them I really haven't. As far as I know, I haven't been published in any of them, and I've got a pretty full plate right now. But I'm not going to go out of my way to pick a fight with them either. So,
all right, very good, very sensible. All right, well, thank you, Gregory. All right.
Thanks, guys, and you know, for anybody watching, and I know it's a real concern, and I understand the fights that are going on right now, and certainly what's happening on X right now is only going to heighten tensions. But it's always been my position that whatever we think about other people in this movement, that we're all the same to the people on the other side, and we all share the same fate, and we may be less powerful than we think we are. So it would behoove us to act with a certain degree of unity, at least when it comes to confronting the other side. So thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you. All right. So I guess that we should just go through the super chats now, because there have been quite a few, and the conversation became so animated and busy that I sort of lost track of that. My apologies to anyone who's been waiting to get their question answered. All right. Alt-White said, can we put this in perspective? H-1B visas for this year was around 750,000. While unvetted, low-skilled illegal aliens in America is estimated at 30 million, at least. Even if Trump doubles the H-1Bs, it's still not even a drop in the bucket. Yeah, but that's 750,000 is that in 1 year? And can anyone, I don't want to say that something completely doesn't inaccurate.
Didn't they say the cap was 80,000 or something per year?
Yeah, I think that.
So he might be doing cumulative numbers there, because that 30 million is a total. That's not an annual.
Yeah.
We're not getting that many.
Yeah. So, well, okay. So 80,000 a year, totaling about 800,000 already. So versus 30 million. Does anyone have anything to say about that?
Oh, and I'm sorry, I'm wrong. I just looked it up. Total number of H-1B visas for the 2024 fiscal year is 780,000.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Wow. That's a lot per year. Anyway, so not as trivial as I thought. Go ahead, Shalom.
Obviously, both of these problems need to be dealt with in a complete way. But I'll just say what I said earlier is that, yeah, there's fewer of these H-1B people coming in, but they probably represent a larger threat because they have this cultural organization that Oliver was referring to repeatedly, and they're being inserted directly into the upper middle class in a lot of cases. And yeah, both of these are very bad problems, but don't discount that just because there are fewer of these people coming in that it's somehow less of a problem, because they're directly, I mean, look at what's happening in Great Britain. I mean, what it comes down to is the Aztecs are a lot more controllable than the people coming in on these H-1B visas. They're you're not simply going to be able to implement policy and direct them as you will and easily get them out of the country, because they have very entrenched actual power built up that these groups south of the border don't actually have. They're clients, right? The groups coming in from south of the border, they are a client group to elites, whereas the people coming in on these H-1Bs are often elites in their own right. And that are those are the people we really need to be worried about.
Yeah, and I just add that this is the first opportunity really that has come by on X or Twitter or whatever since Trump's victory in the election for the public to go after the idea of legal immigration. So, yeah, I agree with Charlemagne entirely. And I would just add that this is an opportunity to make our voices heard more generally as regards legal immigration. You know, it's one of these, opportunities that just appears, I suppose. But it has come across everyone's radar, which is a part of why, you know, I jumped on it as I did. And I wasn't the first to do it. And I'm certainly not one of the most important people to do it. But I think that accounts in large part for why people are hammering this also.
Yeah, I think the argument as to why we don't want 75 IQ savages coming into the country, whether it's Britain or America, that argument has already been made. And the effects, the reasons as to why we were correct are just plentiful. Whereas the argument against so-called elite immigration hasn't really been made yet. This is a chance to really cut that off at the knees, so to speak. And so I think that's sort of the novelty of it is part of why this had to be done right now.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Colin. I think that's it. I'm going to respectfully disagree with my other panelists. I think the Aztecs are a bigger threat, and I think they are underestimated tremendously. Having worked with them, you know, one-on-one for a very long time, they do have organizations here. They are a client class, but so are the H-1Bs. They're a client class as well to the American elite. But I will respectfully agree with my fellow panelists here and say that this is the best strategic time to address the H-1B issue because it is a hot topic. It got in front of everybody. Let's attack it now. Because my stance is both are equally deleterious to the country. Both need to be handled. But strategically, we only have so much power. We only have so much ability to get people's eyes on things. Now, as you said, Colin, we can always make the case for why we don't want 30 million, you know, problems as opposed to why we don't want 75,000 geniuses or 750,000 air quotes geniuses. So I think from a strategic standpoint, we are choosing the right battle, which is the H-1B battle. But I would say that they are both equally terrible. And if I have to choose which is the most obviously terrible in the long run, I would still go with the 30 million. But I don't disagree that I do agree that now is strike while the iron's hot, while we have a blow to strike against legal immigration. Let's do it.
Yeah, definitely. All right. So that's that one. And then, alt-white also said, 30 million blue-collar American workers unable to feed their families, mostly white, is a more pressing immediate priority than less than 1 million college-educated Chinese or Indians. Yeah, I think we've addressed that just now. But I would also add that, and I think this has been touched on, but I'll say it in my own way, high IQ immigration. And I don't think that these, I'll repeat that I don't think their geniuses are, our geniuses are better than their geniuses, is what I really think. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's true. But even so, I don't believe that there is a, are as elite as they're being claimed to be because of all the fraudulent graduate certifications and all that. But let's assume that they are very good. Then that is a threat because that means us being disenfranchised in our own countries at high levels, and it could be very high levels depending on how competent these people actually are. Why would you want that for your own country? Now, I realize that Alt-White is on our side. He's not disputing that this is a threat. It's just, it's a case of we don't actually need to choose between fighting one or the other. We can fight both of these battles at once because in the end, it's we're talking about tweeting. So when it's in that platform, there's no, like, we're not going to run out of bullets, to speak very metaphorically.
What was as a result of the last U.S. election, the results of the last U.S. election, I prefer if you use the phrase, we have the best geniuses. Okay.
Oh, right. Sorry. Yeah.
Well said.
The best in the world. Everyone says
the best.
That. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think to the point that you made about we are just tweeting, not everybody is. You know, there are people who are more organized. Certainly, you know, Old Glory Club is one of those organizations. You know, trying to improve their communities. But I had intended to agree with you and amplify your point, Woz, and to amplify Gregory's point from earlier, which is that you know the idea that our actions are at this point dispositive, you know, that we're the ones who are going to like make all this shit happen or not happen. It's a bit absurd. You know, we'll do what we can. But yeah, tweeting is not going to be the be all end all of the process, though it's important for communication. But in the end, you know, we are to some extent, spectators. Once you step outside of the domain of our own lives, where we can really make the what I think are the most important changes happen.
Indeed, and as someone's just reminded us in the live chat, we you know it was white people who put a man on the moon. It's difficult because it sounds so crass and jingoistic, but I really just think that we don't need anyone else. I think we don't need anyone else. We're fine on our own. We were fine on our own. We were doing damn well. Diversity is not our strength. Even in the best case scenario, we don't actually need it. And in the worst case scenario, it destroys us. So, everyone knows where I stand on this. And then conservative, who likes to post satirical super chats, said, "This is a night for Indians." Thank you, Conservative. That's well received. Yelda says, "Did you see the iHypocrite tweet where he responded to Elon's vaunting of Tesla as an ideal immigrant by quoting Tesla himself, saying something that I can't say out loud? It was about a certain group. Absolute ownage. I didn't see that, but I can believe it." Alt-White said, "Another engaging stream, Woz. You're the best." Well, thank you very much, but I couldn't do it without the guests. Darby said, "Interesting clip of Steve Bannon, him and Jack Posobiec been hammering Elon and Vivek on Indian immigration stuff. Definitely looks like they might have jumped the gun. Trump admin has been very quiet on this, besides a couple tweets from J.D. Vance." I think we've touched on all of that. So does anyone want to say anything about Steve Bannon?
Posobiec, I saw someone who isn't necessarily a fan say he's been great in the current controversy. So credit where it's due, right?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's not just our guys. I mean, even Laura Loomer, for God's sake. Not one of our guys. It's quite a lot of people have really taken the... well, the tech bros to task on this. And I'm glad. Yeah. I'm really glad to see it.
Yeah, that's excellent.
All right. And
the only thing I'd add very quickly on that is Bannon is someone who has really talked about the American worker, and he seems a considerable portion of what he presents seems to be aimed at that kind of working class, you know, like Rust Belt grouping. And so I would expect him to come out with that. Also, Posobiec coming from Pennsylvania or wherever he did, you would expect precisely those people to be tapped to say, hang on a minute, because what we are talking about here is the kind of thing that union people are going to be very able to rapidly put into terms that they have that are already in the proper moral categories for them, right? Like when you think about things like seniority and the rest. You know, as I was talking about earlier in the stream, you'd expect them to come out in this way. And I guess it's I guess I'm agreeing that it's encouraging that they have.
Right. Yeah. I've got the clip of Steve Bannon. I believe it's this one that people are referring to. So here it is. So just a minute and a half long. So I might as well just watch it.
And people say, oh, Steve, you're condemning us to be a third world nation. Anything but the American people rise to the occasion, and they're rising to the occasion now. But you can't sit there and tell the American people this is a problem. We have a capitalist system with no capitalist. It's a concentration of wealth and power. And now you're seeing what they're doing with this, not just illegal immigration. Look, folks, they just brought 15 million people into the country. I was on David Sachs' show on the on election night, and I told the guy, hey, yeah, we're going to deport all 15 million. He, like, freaked out. Seemed like a pretty good guy, but I think this is the guy that put out yesterday's tweet, said we want 1 billion people in the United States, bring in 5 million a year. No, we do not, and not going to have 1 billion people in the United States of America. People already say we're kind of overcrowded right now, particularly out west. The folks are saying, hey, way too much people. You have a bizarre idea of what this country is, no understanding of how we got here. And no idea of what we are going to be in the future. We are not going to be some anarcho-libertarian, you know, big tech, run by big tech oligarchs. That is not going to happen, okay? We haven't fought all these wars and haven't gotten here to give it over to a bunch of geeks that you would stuff and that they're all reacting, being stuffed in the locker in high school. They're having a reaction.
What's not to like?
Yeah, very good, very good. Okay, Thin Red Line said, and this was an hour ago, and it has been alluded to already, Keith Woods just did a great job explaining pro-white politics to Elon Musk on a Twitter space. I have no idea if it was recorded, but it really shows our influence is growing. Well, that's great, and well done to Keith. Fantastic. I'll look forward to I'll check it out. I'll see if I can find it. I hope it was recorded. Then Mighty Crone sent $5. I don't know what that is, but thank you for that. It's an emoji. Nothing New said, there's much I would like to say. I've been listening for years, but I'll try to leave it to thank you to all of you for doing what you do. Thank you, Woz, for bringing all these voices together. Thank you for the tradition. Well, thank you very much, and you're welcome, and it's a pleasure and a privilege to do this. Land of the Fake, Home of the Gay, said, never fear, the anti-white cuck media will always be here and will never cuck on being pro-white. All right, soundboardstation.com. I think it's an advert for that. So if anyone wants to have a look at soundboardstation.com, I don't vouch for it. I've never heard of it until this moment, but somebody has asked me to plug it. So there we go. And then the Celt Denise said something very strident, which I don't want to say out loud, but it alludes to the kind of world that we all want to see, the kind of future we all want for the West. So there we go. Thank you, Denise. I hope you understand why I'm cucking there, and not to say it out loud while I'm in Britain. All right, now let's see. There were quite a few. So Andy said, has anybody noticed on the panel noticed that a number of sizable Twitter accounts have been suspended after criticizing Musk and H1Bs, especially those who have ratioed him over it? Yes, we have talked about this. It's been addressed. So I think we've talked about that from multiple angles, so there's no need to go into it. Unit Tactics wrote, judge people by their actions and not their words. Elon's actions are for importing low IQ Indians that exhibit a slave mentality, ready to work 80 hours a week for what a white American expects for a 40-hour week. This highlights how tech is not evolutionary. Does anyone want to comment on that? Tech not being evolutionary?
Well, I think the whole idea that tech would be evolutionary in any sense is sort of, you know, Whig history or progressivism, the idea that it has to have that trajectory, when in fact, you know, I think of it as something entirely different. Not that there can't be parallels. You know, you get penicillin, you get fewer infections, and people have more life expectancy. But I'm not a person who had come out of the gate assuming that there was any correlation between technology and progress.
Yeah, I think
technology
so.
Doesn't evolve. What did the internet evolve from? Did it evolve from internal combustion engines? Did it evolve from trains? Like it works.
I think he means that it will not evolve society. So it's not. In other words, it doesn't necessarily have positive social effects. Just as because technology is advancing, that doesn't necessarily improve society. I think that's what he meant.
Yeah, I was just looking. I was just looking and worked for a client with cell phones. And I had to do a bunch of research on it. And there's a whole raft now of new medical conditions associated. There's like, what is there? Text finger, text thumb, text neck. There are all kinds of like physical problems and debilitating things that physicians use in talking with their patients. And that now goes into the clinical literature, cell phone elbow, stuff like that. So bad things come with it too.
All right. The NREB says, in Musk's Mars colony mission, an Indian will be the first man to take a shit on Mars. A small shit for mankind, a great shit forward for Indian kind. Yes, indeed. Thank you, NREB.
And there will still be no intelligent life on Mars.
All right. ABC said, I'll play devil's advocate for Musk for a second. In China, there are about 7 million people with an IQ higher than 140. That's quite amazing. In 30 years, China
there's like two people on this stream with a higher IQ with 130.
Yeah. In 30 years, China will have superior military technology than America, unless America becomes a ruthlessly meritocratic society or a hot global war changes everything. Solution comments? Yeah, eugenic, incentivize high IQ people to have more bloody kids.
I mean, I would also argue that I don't think intelligence necessarily means progress either in that sense, because if all they're doing is building better machines, what does that mean for the rest of their society? To kind of go back to riff a little bit off of what a semagogue was saying, it's just pure intelligence. I don't think pure intelligence is what put Europeans in the driver's seat, so to speak. Was it a facet? Yes, but I'm not an IQ fetishist. I think there's a lot of cultural and spiritual aspects to us, not to rehash a conversation completely, but to go back to what we were discussing, mentioning the Greeks, the balance between physicality and intellect. I think there's a lot to be said for balance. I think just because they have so many high IQ people doesn't make them victors. And I'll get off my soapbox very briefly after this. I would also say that if they're so great at developing things and there's so many geniuses, why is every 95% of the stuff they have stolen from our universities? I mean, because that's what most of the F1 visas are. They're foreign students from Asia, China specifically, and they're just CCP agents stealing our intellectual property. So I hesitate to say just because they have X number of geniuses, they're going to win. So
that, yeah, and intelligence has outrageous, especially when you get at the outer end of the bell curve. It correlates really horrifically with neurosis, and things like the paralysis of analysis and the rest, you know.
Yeah, look at to rip off of your point, Semigog, look at Chris Langan. Like, what's his, like, the highest clocked IQ ever? And he's been underemployed his whole life, you know, bouncer, you know, manual labor, farmhand, stuff like that. So I didn't mean to cut you off. I meant to support your point. Forgive me for cutting you off.
No, not at all. Not in the slightest. That's all I really wanted to say. It's just there's a huge cost to that. When you're highly intelligent, from what I've seen of highly intelligent people, there's a it's a risk, because highly intelligent people want to innovate, and innovation is always a risk. Whereas the tradition, the things embraced by the collective, have to a large extent, except until recently, when all the mechanisms of achieving consensus have been subverted, the things that people go with as tradition are generally safer, you know, like don't fuck your first cousins, and innovation, you know, don't try to sexually liberate your children. Don't cut women's tits off, you know, even leaving aside the subversion aspect, highly intelligent people and many of the leftists who laid out these programs were highly intelligent. And many of them believed that they could, you know, re-engineer man, you know, that we had no need for religion and the rest. Yeah, there's a huge risk that comes with it. And so I'm reinforcing your point, Charles.
All right. And then Unit Tactics also said, Grok, which is the AI built into Twitter, Grok is explicitly anti-white and controlled by Elon. Elon has posted explicitly anti-white statements. To want to keep him on side is a weak talking point. Weakness is why we are losing. Charlemagne, I think you were the one of the ones who said we should want to keep him on side. So what would you say to that?
Well, it's obvious that there's been a lot of freedom on Twitter. You know, I know some people have been freed, but we've been unleashed on Twitter ever since he came on board. So he's done us that favor, at least. And frankly, we're in a very precarious position. And there's basically no one even willing to put a toe in the pool of helping us at all. So what other options do we have? I mean, if the Trump administration is to succeed at all on fulfilling remotely any of its promises, we need people like Musk on board and not fighting against us. We have enough enemies as it is. You know, that doesn't mean we have to like everything these people stand for or anything like that. Basically, everyone's anti-white now. So it's like, how's that even a particular distinguishing mark against him? I mean, this is just the reality of the situation. I don't know what to say.
It goes back to what Gregory was talking about before. I think some people have, and I'm not trying to go after the person that made this comment, but where is our great strength? You know, say we kick him to the curb and we you know, I'm going to take my football home. What do we do then? There is such an expression, as my mother used to tell me quite often, that I'm more sure than right. And there's also the old expression, you know, cutting off your nose to spite your face. I'm not saying that he's the best thing since sliced bread, but there are tangible benefit to him having come on board at X that I enjoy now. I did not before. And you catch more flies with honey. You know, if we were in a position where we could just come in and, you know, enforce our will by dictate, you know, we wouldn't be as weak as we are. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. The weakness is something that we are weak. You know, we are weak at this point.
Good point. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to add the point, as Charlemagne's been sharing with us, play by play, as Musk continues to sort of moderate his stance, even as we've been doing the stream. I think those of us who have been really thinking about this stuff for a long time, we've been in the scene, we are thinking, this is a little unfair, but, you know, sort of ideologically, right? Hey, they're anti-white. They must sort of be as anti-white as we are pro-white, or, you know what I mean? But I don't think that's the case for someone like Elon Musk. This is not his issue, right? And so he'll make a statement, and that'll set off our alarm bells as, oh, he is totally an enemy. He's totally an anti-white enemy or whatever. And then 24 hours later, he's taking a different stance, right? because it's just not really what he's about. He's about like going to Mars and stuff, right? Yeah. So don't necessarily, you know, you need to put these things in context of sort of what their goals are, right? I don't think Elon Musk's goals are like to destroy European civilization, right? He might accidentally do it, but I don't think that's like what his agenda is, right? So let's find a way where our agenda and his agenda, we can find some overlap and have some win-win. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree. And Denise Kelt has pointed out, she asked Grok to make an image of an Indian defecating on Mars, and she got one. So Grok is obviously a friend to Denise. All right. And then K.R. Harris said, gentlemen, thanks to all of you for the work you do. Remember, we win, they lose. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. Well, thank you very much, KR. And I missed one from Unit Tactics. He also said, when in university, we had an Indian female lecturing one of our classes. She was a PhD student, and this was one of her jobs. The topic was global economics. During the classes, she would plagiarize word for word Investopedia. They are deceivers. Well, this seems to be a very common thing with Indians. And I'm not going to say that they're genetically bound to do this, but it does seem to be a very common complaint of them that they plagiarize and, you know, defraud and cheat and lie and exaggerate, gild the lily, all the fucking time. I mean, so many people have said this. So yeah, I think the surprise is when you see it with someone like that in a sort of upper middle class job, you assume, as Radlib was saying earlier, we tend to assume that the world works, society works a certain way, and that people in certain positions are there because of not just raw ability, but also moral integrity. And what we see with some newcomers to our society is that that's not the case at all. And they're perfectly prepared to cheat their way into those positions of authority and prestige. So, yeah, it's disheartening because you realize that your society really isn't bulletproof. It's it can be gamed by people willing to do that, and it's rather disgusting. A friend of mine who's into crypto stuff said, regardless of the fact that the battleground and public square is on X at this moment, the fundamental problem is that it's a platform, and this power of banning and censoring is there in the first place. In the long term, we need a solution to platforms itself. There is a solution, and it is called Nostr, Nostr. There is no organization, business, blockchain, token, or whatever behind it. It is an open protocol for social networking. It allows for freedom of association and protects you from censorship. Is it a long shot? Yes. But it is invented by Bitcoiners and being built by Bitcoiners, and we are used to dedicating ourselves to long shots. We know what we are doing, and we have fuck you money to persist. Please have a look at Nostr, Nostr, in your own time. Thank you. So that was a super chat that he's mentioned it to me before, and I don't know anything about it, but he's been talking about it for about a year now. Apparently, Jack Dorsey is involved in it in some way. So the financing side of it. So it's interesting. It's something that might well become more well known to all of us in the future. I don't know yet. But yeah, the whole thing about the platforms is that, see, this is where it gets up against human nature, and we're going way off topic here, but I'll say this. People actually want platforms because it means that there's a place they can go to watch videos, YouTube. There's a place they can go to read stuff, Substack. There's a place they can go to get quickfire opinions, Twitter. And they don't need to go to 100 different websites to get the same stuff. So this thing about platforms, I think, is it can only be a double-edged sword, because people want the thing for the good stuff that it brings. They just don't want the bad stuff that it brings. But it's like, you know, I wish that you could have a platform that just didn't censor in some stupid way. But unfortunately, that doesn't exist. Because the thing is, as I say, people want the public square. That's it. They don't want 100 different YouTubes. They want one YouTube where everyone is.
Yeah.
That's none the of way us, social none, media works.
None of us want spam, but you know, one man's spam is another man's censorship. You know, one man's anti-spam is another man's censorship. So I think you're going the right direction, Wes, which is if we imagine that this is just an easy problem to solve, and it just, you know, I don't think it is an easy problem to solve. I think there's a fundamental, sort of set the technology aside, there's a fundamental social challenge to having a public square, right?
Yeah,
and it's a hard problem.
It comes back to I've forgotten the Latin, but
who watches the Watchmen?
Yeah, exactly.
And so, it comes down to the fact that no one wants to go into an empty bar. I mean, I haven't been around as long
exactly.
as Rhodes, but I mean, I remember VidMe. Do you remember VidMe and how VidMe was going to be the place we could all go, and then BitChute, and then Odyssey, and none of them ever achieved the same critical mass to become a public square. I'm all for it, and I like the branding, you know, Noster meaning ours, you know, like the Pater Noster. I remember everyone telling me that Urbit was going to be the next new thing, and I couldn't even figure out how to do a fucking thing with it. But you know, if it works out, that could be cool. I'm all for it.
He's saying in Noster, the content is just there. You can use any app you want. It doesn't matter. The content is not scattered over many places. Okay, so I take the point. I'll try to find out more about Noster so that because I don't want to mislead anyone or say anything that's untrue about it. And I've got no opinion on it at this point, one way or the other, just to make that clear. I wish them the best, and I hope it is good. All right, then. Now, there was one more super chat. All right, Mr. Cholly said, thanks, Woz. I asked this question for the Germans, not sure if it was asked. Does anyone on the panel have... Yes, it was asked, so you should... It's about halfway through that stream, I think, if you want to go and have a look. Does anyone on the panel have some New Year predictions on whether the Nuremberg regime, the post-war consensus, is going to start to unravel, and how much chaos the Martyr-Made podcast on World War II is ultimately going to cause? Charlemagne.
Well, I could tell you, and I think Stephen knows this as well, when Martyr-Made releases his World War II podcast, and I don't know the guy, I have this information from other places, it's going to be a bomb, let's just put it that way. So definitely look forward to that.
Okay. Does anyone else want to talk about the unraveling of the post-war consensus?
I think the only prediction I would offer is really somewhat lazy on my part, but I will answer it. I think it's already begun to unravel. I think we've already seen the first few threads of the sweater being pulled at, and now it's just going to go from there. This is not the kind of thing that's going to slow down or suddenly grind to a halt. It's only going to increase, if for no other reason than because it's been a taboo subject for so long. And now that the door is open and permission has been given to investigate it, and you can interpret my meaning however you like, whatever permission you want is it's up for debate. But now that people feel more comfortable investigating it, now that there's not as strong, shall we say, a social taboo against it, I think it's just going to continue to unravel. So the TLDR answer I'm giving is I think it's already unraveling, and it's just going to precipitously continue.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it was already happening before October 7th, and that they're never going to come back from that.
I'm not qualified to say anything, so I'll just hold off. I don't know as much about the consensus, how it was formed, and the history of everything. So,
yeah. All right. And then finally, Alt White sent a very generous super chat, thank you, and said, really enjoyed this new format, Woz. Look forward to more of these in the future. Well, thank you very much. There'll be another three this year, and then there'll be the open open hangout, which will be open to everyone. So that'll be at the on the 30th. So that or sorry, the 29th. So that's going to be a different thing again. We'll see how that goes. But all right. Is there anything else that any of you would like to say about this the topic that we've really been wrangling with here, which is the H-1B thing, but also what it reflects about America as a society today? Does anyone have any closing comments on that?
I'll go because I'm fast for once. I just want to hammer the point that you made, Woz, and I didn't realize it was from an earlier piece of yours, but it just really does sum it up. So I'll just steal your shit and say it again. It really does just seem to be blah, 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 blah. You're the problem and we need to fix you. We're always the problem. And the solution is always outside ourselves, from the guidance of some other group or the importation of some replacement group. I mean, it's one of those little expressions that you hear someone say and you never forget it, because it just sums it all up. And I like it so much. I just want to promote you again.
Well, thank you. I should be clear. I made that phrase was today. The video from 10 years ago was different. It was just making the point that there's always some economic argument for immigration. Whatever the circumstances are, there's some economist who will use the available data to concoct an argument as to why we need to import more people. So, and the public can't make head nor tail of it. So it's a sort of, as I said earlier, sort of woo-woo. So that was the point of it. But the tweet today was just, it's just whatever they're doing, it seems to always end up with the policy prescription is more immigration. That was the point. Charles?
The only thing I'll say on it, just to keep things moving along, and everybody I'm sure wants to go at this point, the only thing I'll say is, and since this is a specifically United States banquet, I'll say this. The United States has its flaws, yes, but we have accomplished so much in so little time comparatively. We have been a country for not even 300 years. So we don't need H-1Bs. It sounds, as you say, crass, but we put a man on the moon. I can't even tell you the amount of technological, social progress we've made, if you want to measure things that way. And if you don't want to measure it that way, the levels of prosperity we've enjoyed. Sure, we could all make fun of the obese people riding around on a scooter in Walmart, but that's a level of prosperity that everybody really envies. They may not envy the manifestation of that prosperity, but they envy the ability to have it. The standard of living we've enjoyed in the previous to my time here, I'm talking about probably before the 1980s or 90s, but the argument could still be made even now. The level of the lifestyle we're able to enjoy, the prosperity we have, the accomplishments we've made, we don't need them. You know, we hewed this country out of the wilderness, and we can keep doing it ourselves. And that's just the nature of our people.
Yeah. Somebody has found it was just shared by Red Ice, actually. So it was the thing. This is the article that I mentioned that I saw earlier today. 94.5% of Indian developers not qualified with basic programming skills. this is perhaps.
Whoops.
Yeah, this perhaps explains why so many people in IT complain about the work done by their Indian colleagues, because they're fucking incompetent and untrained. They just don't know. They just don't have the training. So they get there then through, I don't know, cheating, lying, fake resumes. I don't know. Look at the person who wrote it. I mean, you know, that's not going to be some, you know, white supremacist. Maybe a vicarious one. Interesting.
May I respond to that original question real quick? Kind of reiterating what's been said, but you know, as we've said, we don't morally need to justify holding on to our society for the sake of economic efficiency or engineering brilliance or whatever, right? We can protect Western societies and the American society and nation in particular, because it's right to protect your own people, right? Yeah, we don't have to we don't have to make a bunch of other arguments. So, but we can also combine that with what Charles was just saying, which is that we are fully capable of doing great things with heritage Americans. We don't need the help, as was said earlier. We can make it on our own. Do it, you know. So I think that it's encouraging to think about those two things simultaneously. That we have the power of truth on our side on two fronts, right? Which is that we're justified in protecting our society, our nation, because that's right and it's ours. And also, we know that we have a track record as Americans of accomplishing great things, and we can do it again. We're literally being held back by, you know, this imperial structure or whatever it is that's disfavoring white males and all this craziness. So it's we've got a double barreled shotgun. Is what I'm saying on this stuff.
Yeah,
brilliant.
Metaphorically speaking,
brilliantly stated, Brad. Brilliant. Well done.
And Charlemagne, any closing remarks?
Yes. As Oliver mentioned earlier, we are weak, but our weakness, we are growing stronger. I'm not going to sit here and say we're winning, but we are having a real influence, a real effect, not impact, on the politics of our country. We've watched in real time, over the course of this stream, the position of Musk moderate and be negotiated on the public square that is Twitter. And at least some of this is due to our influence. I can say with 100% certainty, we know for a fact that there are elites whose names everyone in America knows, who are very closely tied to the incoming administration, who are reading our Substacks, who are listening to our streams and podcasts, and our influence is growing, and it's real. It's not some sort of fantasy. You're not coping if you believe that what we're doing is achieving a purpose. It is taking a long time. It's very difficult, but we are growing stronger. Like I said, I'm not going to say we're winning, but we are becoming less weak, and that's really important. And if I may, perhaps this might be a good time to shield the Old Glory Club, unless you had another outro segment planned.
No, go for it.
Right. So the Old Glory Club is an organization, you know, B and Radlib and Ryan Turnipseed are all founders of and a part of and current or former officers of. And what this is a fraternal organization, first and foremost, organized into chapters built around specific localities. I think when we streamed with you last year, we had two chapters, the Vetus Dominium Club in Virginia and the New Ivy League in New England. We now have 14 chapters spread across, I think, a quarter of the states in the Union, and we have over 100 members, and we are forming real fraternal bonds with our fellow Americans. And moreover, we've made real accomplishments for our people. And I'd like to shout out in particular our friends Melon and Jay Ford, Melon the Giraffe on Twitter and J_FordXYZ on Twitter. These guys have been in the recovery zone for Hurricane Helene in the Carolinas for weeks, if not months, directly organizing and assisting in the affected areas. And they have done major, literally life-saving work, organizing people down there, organizing the various aid groups that were not working together and now are working together. So you can have real positive effects for your people and do great work for your race right now. And we're one of the organizations helping to facilitate that. If you go to the oldgloryclub.com, you can find out more information about our chapters. I've recently added a slash map page where you can click on the various states and see if there's a chapter in your area. Tomorrow, in fact, we will be doing a live stream on our channel. I think Dave the Distributist will be there, along with our president, Red Hawk. And we're going to be raising money at the request of Mr. J. Ford to raise money for building supplies for these people to, you know, rebuild, to help rebuild a limited number of houses. So this is the kind of thing we're doing. This is the kind of thing you can get involved with. I highly recommend, especially if you feel isolated and like there's no one you can talk to. I mean, it's been incredible how many people we have brought together who now have real friendships and bonds of brotherhood where there were none at all before. So you don't have to be alone. Check out our website, email us, and, you know, check out the stream tomorrow. Donate if you're able to. We should have a PayPal up and also entropy donations, and 100% of that is going to be going directly to purchasing building supplies to rebuild in North Carolina for our people. So that's all I've got, unless you want to add anything, Red.
Yeah, I'll just add real quickly that, you know, we've done the internet thing for a long time. It's been useful. It's put us in touch with each other. It's helped us formulate our ideas. We're not going to stop doing it. But we really have felt that it's time to take things off the internet and into real life. And so that's what we're doing with the Old Glory Club and the chapters. I just say that, you know, all we have is each other, but that's enough.
All right. On that optimistic white pill note, I did see a Telegram post about the Old Glory Club donation drive and in aid of the hurricane victims. I was going to share it tomorrow, but I'm glad that this has been mentioned here as well, because it sounds like a very worthy cause indeed. So congratulations on doing that. Okay, well, this has been a good stream. I'm still trying to work out how to do this. But yeah, it's certainly been fun. And I think we've covered a lot of ground and really gone into this topic in exhaustive depth, actually. So, all right, excellent. I will be back tomorrow with, let me just see this. I think it's
While you're looking, everyone, please go to my Substack and subscribe. Woz has been hammering me to promote it. I have a Substack called The Royal Book of Spiritual Chivalry. Please go and subscribe.
Yes, do that, everyone. And tomorrow it is the England banquet and then the Canada banquet. So those will be, no doubt, very different again. So we'll see how they go. All right. In the meantime, I don't think there are any more questions coming in, so that's fine. Okay. Thank you to everyone who took part and the four of you who are still here. I think at one point we had 9, actually, which is quite strange to see that. But I think this has gone well. So thank you, everyone, for taking part. I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? Commemorating 10 years of Millennial, this unique animated vector graphic is available as an NFT for one lucky owner, and only one. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today.